Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
And now you have written your first book, Breakthrough. And we are taping this show the day after the inauguration of Barack Obama, and you spent the afternoon while some of us were in a nice warm studio. You were out there actually doing reporting.
Yeah.
And I want to first ask you about that event and how that fits in with your book, but I should preface by saying it, you did a fantastic report interviewing people on the Mall.
Thank you.
And I know it's fantastic because Mark Shields and I were following you, and the worst thing happened to us, which is that we're watching your report. And you were interviewing two women in particular, one, I think, 105-year-old woman, and another woman on the Mall who was talking about what this day meant for her son. And while she's talking, you know, tears are coming to Jim Lehrer, Shields, and our eyes. And because we're manly men, we can't admit that. So we sort of get automatic allergies in the studio. We start blowing our noses. I discover lint in my eye. But you were out there on the Mall.
Oh, it was amazing.
And so describe, first of all, your reflections on the day, and then how it fits into the larger picture.
It was like shooting fish in a barrel in the Mall yesterday. Everyone we talked to would just start spouting off in these long and eloquent, perfectly formed sentences about what this meant to their lives. And all you had to do is walk up and say hello, and they would start talking. And so this woman in particular was toward the very end, right at the oath-taking. We had talked to a lot of people all morning. And my cameraman turned around from one direction, I turned around from the other, and we both saw this woman fall to her knees on the Mall and start crying. And needless to say, cameraman started shooting her. And then afterward, we ran after her and chased her and said, can we talk to you about this? Now, this is one of the beautiful things about people who follow politics. These are PBS viewers. So they immediately see you and say, oh, and start to tell you these things. And when she was kind of funny, because when I first asked her, why are you crying? She said, well, first, I've been crying all day, first because it was so cold. And then she said, you're going to get me in trouble here, and she started crying again. And it was impossible not to talk to someone like that who said, I have a son, and you see, I'm going to get verklempt thinking about it. I have a son, and now he knows that he doesn't have to be a rapper, he doesn't have to be an athlete, he can be whatever he wants. The roof is off, the sky is open, he can do whatever he wants. No excuses. It's a theme which I've been hearing all inauguration and run-up to the inauguration, especially from African Americans, saying we don't have excuses anymore. Sure, we were denied things. Sure, we had to fight for things. But here is a man who, and you know, it's exactly the message he's sending. He's saying to you, government ought to help, and I think government ought to help you, but you ought to give back too. This is something which not only do African Americans embrace, but it turns out all Americans embrace. If there's been tension between the races over the years, it's had to do with the fact that someone thought an unfair demand was being made of them. How dare you make me feel guilty for the sins of my ancestors? Or why should I give you an affirmative action advantage when my child doesn't get it? There's always been this tension. And what Obama represents on one level, he represents many things, of course, but is the idea that we're going to try to get past that and talk about the things that we all need to benefit from government, not just one group or another.
Right.
And oddly enough, people have completely embraced that.
Mm-hmm.
So that came out a million different ways, and not just from the black mother, but also from the 105-year-old woman who heard W.E.B. Du Bois speak when she was a student at Fisk University in 1926, you know. Also from the white middle-class family from Champaign, Illinois, and from Boulder, Colorado, who came all this way because they just wanted to stand in the cold on the Mall for hours at a time on crazy metro trains just so they can say they'd been there. It was an amazing day.
Yeah. And that, in the book, and I think the book is really about the Exodus story, or at least a chapter in the Exodus story of the Civil Rights Revolution, the different generations. And then the book, and in my mind, the core story of the book is that Barack Obama is not alone.
Right.
That a lot of people had similar, not the same obvious experience, but similar experience, similar rises, and he is part of a cohort, and you're telling the story of that cohort.
Absolutely.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, December 23rd, 2016. So I have been told the audio segment that you heard at the beginning, that was the late Gwen Ifill. That is from an interview that she conducted, as you heard, January of 2009. That full one-hour interview is available on C-SPAN. You can go online. If you put in Gwen Ifill, that will be the first video. If you look at all the videos that she's done over the years, and there are a lot where they have the video where she was moderating the 2008 and 2004 vice presidential debates. She hosted some of the forums that they had for the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. They have some of that footage available as possible. Just really remarkable, stellar career as a journalist spanning decades. But that segment that we heard, I thought it was great because it gets right to what I think is kind of the spirit, the zeitgeist, if you will, of that point in history, particularly this part of the world, the election of President Obama. I think a lot of the emotion and rhetoric that you heard in that interview and the optimism, I think that is throughout the book. It's kind of the main theme of the book at that time, not just with President Obama, although he's kind of the standard bearer, but with all these other figures that we're going to begin to hear about throughout the rest of the book, including Cory Booker, cowbell, among others. We already heard about Harold Ford. I guess that might be a cowbell too. At any rate, this is our third study session, The Breakthrough: Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. We are picking up in chapter four. We're in the midway point. Chapter four is the race gender clash. Last week, where she talked about a lot of the vehement white female racism that was on display throughout the 2008, really she's talking about the Democratic primary when it was still between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama at the time. Without further ado, we will get started, take good notes, and we will be looking forward to a constructive exchange. Context of white supremacy, Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough: Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, audio segment number one.
Perhaps Obama's rhetorical 10-foot pole kept him safely out of the middle of the race-gender debate that particular day, but it raged all around him. Only in the voting booth does the public get to exercise any latent bias they harbor in complete privacy and with complete impunity. That makes the stakes especially high. Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman to run for president, always maintained gender was the higher hurdle. In a speech she delivered in 1970, she sketched out her dilemma. "The harshest discrimination I have encountered in the political arena is anti-feminism, both from males and brainwashed Uncle Tom females," she said at a conference on women's employment in Washington. "When I first announced I was running for Congress, both males and females advised me, as they had when I ran for the New York State Legislature, to go back to teaching, a women's vocation, and leave the politics to the men." Certainly for African-American women, the ceiling has been especially high. There are 11 African-American women in the U.S. House of Representatives, none in the U.S. Senate, and only one serving in a statewide office, Connecticut Treasurer Denise Napier. Carol Mosley Braun, in fact, is the only black woman ever to have served in the Senate. The numbers are better in the nation's state legislatures, where in 2008, African-American women occupied 237 of the 1,748 seats held nationwide. But the number of black women holding statewide elective office is on the decline. And although none of the black women in Congress arrived prior to 1991, in the year Barack Obama ran for president, only two were younger than 45. The barriers to higher office are varied and complicated, but sometimes the simplest episodes illustrate the problem. When Mosley Braun ran for president in 2004, she frequently arrived on stage at candidates' debates wearing her trademark tailored skirt suits, only to discover she was expected to climb onto high stools and perch there throughout, her knees clamped awkwardly together, while her male competitors sprawled comfortably. Gender, she later told former Vermont Governor Madeleine Cunin, is more intractable than race. No wonder Hillary Clinton has spent her entire political career in slacks. She even poked fun at herself on this point when she was being urged to quit the race in 2008. "It's not over until the lady in the pantsuit sings," she said, while clad in, yes, a butter yellow pantsuit. Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin worked in city government for three black mayors before she was recruited to run herself. Franklin, who was by then in her 50s, sees another reason for the ceilings many female candidates confront. "I did not think that I was worthy to serve," she told me as we sat in her airy city hall office. "Now I'm 63. My generation is different from the one you're going to meet at 35 and 45 and 55. Franklin remembers old debates about whether successful black women were keeping black men down, but says she hears that less now. Her challenge, which she considers an advantage, is incorporating her blackness, her femaleness, and her municipal expertise into a single package. "I can see things as a woman, and I can see things as an African-American," said Franklin, who decided to support Obama early on. "And I can see things as a mayor. I can put on a lens. How do I feel about this as a mayor? Who has the best policy for urban America? That's seeing it as a mayor. I can look at the historical exclusion of women and say, I don't care who he is, it's time for a woman. Or I can look as an African American and say, this is the progression of leadership that Dr. King talked about and people before him." But this race-gender power conflict has been playing out for decades. The civil rights movement that forced racial change on a nation always seemed somewhat conflicted about the role of women. Rosa Parks may have been hailed as the mother of the movement for refusing to give up her seat on a municipal bus in Montgomery, Alabama, and Fannie Lou Hamer may have forced her Mississippi Freedom Party into the state's all-white delegation to the 1964 Democratic National Convention, but many more of the movement's women essentially stayed in the background, laboring in obscurity as the Kings, Youngs, and Abernathys led the marches. Dorothy Height, the venerable 96-year-old leader of the National Council of Negro Women, credits women with roles in all facets of the civil rights movement in her 2003 memoir, Open Wide the Freedom Gates. But one of the most telling photos contained in the book shows Dr. Height standing with the NAACP's Roy Wilkins, the Congress of Racial Equality's Floyd McKissick, A. Philip Randolph of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, Whitney Young of the National Urban League, and Martin Luther King Jr. The caption reads, "The one woman in the crowd." In another photo, capturing the crowd gathered around King at the Lincoln Memorial at the March on Washington in 1963, the only recognizable women are Height, Coretta Scott King, and gospel singer Mahalia Jackson. There has been documentable improvement. The Department of Education reports that more than two-thirds of all bachelor's degrees earned by African Americans are awarded to women, a number that rises for master's degrees. Still, a study conducted by the Brookings Institution found that 83 nations have greater percentages of women in their national legislatures than the United States, and that the number of women in public office had not changed markedly in a decade. The reason, according to the report, is not sexism, it is an ambition gap. The fundamental reason for women's underrepresentation is that they do not run for office, the report concluded. There is a substantial gender gap in political ambition. Men tend to have it, and women don't. "It's like the train left and we weren't on it," one black female politician told me. "I think we decided we didn't even want to get a ticket, and that's the difference." The ceiling for women in general and for black women in particular really kicks in at the executive level. In 2008, there were 8 women governors, including Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin, but none was black. And only 2 big city mayors, Baltimore Mayor Sheila Dixon and Atlanta Mayor Franklin, are black women. Dixon's rise is a case in point. When she was elected the city's 48th mayor in 2007, she received 88% of the vote. But she had a major advantage. She had been elevated from city council president the year before when the previous mayor, Martin O'Malley, was elected governor. She too sees gender as a greater challenge than race. After decades of community and church work, Dixon now comfortably occupies the second floor executive suite. But she clearly remembers the resistance that another woman, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, the daughter of Democratic icon Robert F. Kennedy, encountered when she ran for Maryland governor in 2002. "I was a woman in meetings with individuals who made it very clear, 'I'm not supporting no woman for governor,'" Dixon recalls of being the only woman in the room. "I mean, here I was, sitting at the table." Townsend lost. But there are considerably more women in the crowd in Baltimore these days. When she took office in late 2007, Dixon became the lead in an unusual foursome of municipal leadership. She not only was the city's first female chief executive, but also made the journey to City Hall in the company of 3 other black women who were elected city council president, comptroller, and state's attorney. This was the first time that had happened in Baltimore's 200 years. At her inaugural at the city's historically black Morgan State University, Dixon's pastor, Frank M. Reed III, prayed, "We thank you, God, for the women who opened the door of opportunity and would never turn back." In the address that followed, Dixon quoted abolitionist, former slave, and early feminist Sojourner Truth, who said women together ought to be able to turn the world, quote, right side up again. "It took a long time for a woman to prevail and earn the right to represent this city and its people," she said. "Too long." That night, she wore a floor-length one-shoulder gown and pearls to her inauguration ball. For the first time in history, the mayor's fashion choice was news. Still, some of the hesitation black women face differs little from the choices all women make. Political life, said Dixon, who is divorced, also took a toll on her personal life. "It's a lot of work if you're really committed," she confided while sitting at the conference table in her City Hall office. "It's a lot of sacrifices you make with your family. In my case, my second husband had a real tough time dealing with the fact that I had ambitions. And God knows, don't call him Mr. Dixon. His name is Hampton. He had a real problem with that." San Francisco District Attorney Kamala Harris, who is single and has no children, is just as blunt when she describes the challenges facing an ambitious woman who wants to rise in politics. "The round-the-clock commitment elected politics often requires," she confessed to me, "is based on a lifestyle," she said, "that a mother cannot have. But it's not because she's not up at midnight doing the work after the babies have gone to sleep. She may not be at a cocktail reception after work. She might not be at the community meetings at 7 o'clock because she's got to get those babies fed and get their homework done and get them in bed." Karen Carter Peterson, the Speaker pro tempore of the Louisiana House, got married last year and is considering a second race for Congress. "Certainly my husband and I are talking about kids," she says. "I'm 38 years old. I'm Speaker pro tem of the House. So how does that play into our future goals? Am I going to be a pregnant congresswoman? How does that impact a new marriage? There are a lot of realities that I think men do not have." Women are not the only ones taking stock of the race-gender divide and looking for ways to close the gap. Florida Democrat Kendrick Meek, one of a group of African-American members of Congress who endorsed Hillary Clinton in spite of pressure to hop aboard the Obama bandwagon, said his decision was heavily influenced by the experiences of the woman whose seat he inherited, Carrie Meek, who served in Congress from 1993 to 2003. "I look at my own mother," he said, "who should have been a U.S. senator, in my opinion, or should have been governor of the state of Florida, because that's what her qualifications were, thinking-wise. She carried that wisdom. But she couldn't do it because of the limitations of people saying, 'You know, Carrie, you have to wait,' or 'We're not quite ready for that kind of thing.'" But Clinton's near-miss presidential campaign did end up putting the possibility of a female president tantalizingly within reach. Obama's campaign sealed the deal on race. What about black women, though? The reality is, no one seriously thinks that if you're a white female who has qualifications and can raise money, that there is any impediment for you running for governor or senator, Representative Artur Davis told me. We're still not certain about the presidency, but for governor or senator, there is no one who believes that in any state in the country, if you are a strong enough candidate, there is a barrier if you're a white female. We obviously haven't reached that point with race, he added. Chapter 5, Artur Davis. We don't have any illusions about race. We absolutely know for a group of voters that race will be an inaccessible fact. Most of those voters, I'm not going to reach. But the whole premise is that there are enough voters left over who are willing to move beyond their racial bias. Representative Artur Davis. On a sizzling day in downtown Birmingham, Artur Davis is strolling through the heart of the four-acre Kelly Ingram Park, pointing out the truly fearsome statue of bare-fanged dogs snarling at terrified children. This is not the bronze Confederate general that would normally occupy a place of honor in a southern town square. The park is peaceful today, occupied only by a few men lounging under shade trees, who roused themselves to call out a hello to Davis, their 40-year-old congressman. Keep doing a good job in Washington, one says. I will if we get Obama elected, he responds. 45 years before this hazy summer day, there was nothing at all peaceful happening in this park. The snapping dogs in the statue were real, and they were lunging at the child protesters who had gathered there to participate in a civil rights march. High-pressure fire hoses were turned on them, too, all under the approving eye of Public Safety Commissioner Bull Connor and the disapproving eye of photographers on hand from national publications. One of the photos taken that summer, coincidentally, is mounted on the wall facing Mayor Cory Booker's desk in Newark, New Jersey. Davis and I returned here to talk about struggle and ambition. Across the street from the park stands the 16th Street Baptist Church, where four young girls were killed when attackers placed a bomb just outside the building 4 months after the hoses were used in the park. On another corner, the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute preserves much of that history in exhibits that include original drinking fountains labeled white and colored. I wasn't even born yet, Davis mused aloud, but the history means too much to me not to absorb it. Davis, a 1986 graduate of Birmingham's Jefferson Davis High School, now wants to make history again. This time he has his eye on the governor's office in Montgomery, once occupied by George Wallace, who used it to launch his cry of segregation forever. Talk about the audacity of hope. Something is happening here in our lifetimes, Davis said to a group of visiting Virginia schoolteachers he encountered at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute on the day we visited. It's what happened in Doug Wilder's lifetime. When you see history begin to move and bend in real time, you have to be moved by that. Artur Davis, pronounced that way, as his mother, a French teacher, intended, was born in Montgomery in 1967, well after the worst racial strife in his native city had played itself out. Bus boycotts and church bombings were by then hallmarks of the nation's ugly past, but the echoes of segregation still lived on, even in Davis's own story. He lived with his divorced mother and grandmother in a house near the railroad tracks. His father had left the family when Artur was 2 years old. The two men talk occasionally now, but Davis credits his ambition to the women who raised him. It was his mother who introduced him to the possibility of a government career in 1977 on an Easter weekend visit to the state archives in Montgomery. By the time he graduated from high school, Davis wanted to expand his horizons and leave Alabama to go to college. He chose Harvard, where he earned undergraduate and law degrees with honors. It would not be far off the mark to read his biography after that as a carefully plotted political career map. Davis interned for Alabama Senator Howell Heflin, clerked for U.S. District Court Judge Myron Thompson, and worked for the Southern Poverty Law Center before moving on to become an assistant U.S. attorney for 4 years. After a stint in private practice, the young man turned his eyes to elective politics, and he never looked back. Just over 20 years later, after two tries, he was elected to Congress by defeating an entrenched black incumbent. It was very much a leap of faith, Davis says now, very much a long shot. Davis was something of a student of political breakthroughs. While he was at Harvard in the 1980s, he watched carefully as Atlanta's Andrew Young, Virginia's Wilder, and New York's David Dinkins all claimed big offices for the first time. 18 years ago, he told me, the common theme appeared to be that strong black candidates were showing an ability to raise money and ability to trump race in their particular contest. It seemed reasonable to think that other strong candidates would come along who would demonstrate the same capacity. For whatever reason, that didn't happen. Some of the breakthrough candidates, such as Illinois Senator Carol Mosley Braun, won election and then struggled in office. Others, including North Carolina Senate nominee Harvey Gantt and gubernatorial nominee Ron Kirk in Texas, reached for the brass ring and fell short. So Davis picked his path and his target carefully. Earl Hilliard, then 60 years old, seemed ripe for an ambitious 34-year-old's maiden political assault. When Hilliard was elected to represent the 14 counties that make up Alabama's 7th District in 1992, he became the state's first black congressman since Reconstruction. Before that, he served 18 years in the Alabama state legislature, mastering the ropes and pulleys of power. It didn't take long for Hilliard to settle comfortably into the rhythms of Washington and to establish enduring ties with other members of the Congressional Black Caucus and with Democratic leaders. When he decided to challenge Hilliard in 2000, Davis ran head-on against all of that entrenched support, raising only $85,000 in a naive and cautious campaign. Even his advisors suggested he prepare to run and lose his first time. Still, with the help of an endorsement from Birmingham's new African-American mayor, Bernard Kincaid, the ambitious political neophyte came within 5 percentage points of victory, exposing a flank of political weakness he would be able to exploit 2 years later. It's clear to me, as I look back over the conversations we had, that he knew exactly what he was doing from the outset, said Natalie Davis, no relation, a political science professor at Birmingham Southern College. He knew exactly how he could win, and when he found in the second go-round the vulnerability that Hilliard had, he was able to put together a winning coalition. Part of Hilliard's vulnerability arose from redrawn district lines that moved him away from his base of support, adding more white voters to his district. Part of it came from the fact that Davis had a lot more money to spend the second time around. Courting just those white voters, he raised and spent nearly $1 million. In 2002, neither candidate won enough votes in the June primary to avoid a runoff. That set the stage for a furious 3-week campaign funded in large part by non-local supporters. The money went to pay for ads, such as one run by Davis, that accused Hilliard of accepting $1.3 million in congressional salary over 10 years, but failing to introduce education, health care, economic development, or civil rights bills. Instead, the ad concluded tartly, Hilliard sponsored legislation regulating endangered rabbits. Hilliard responded in kind with ads accusing Davis of selling out to out-of-state contributors who funneled money into his campaign, including Republicans who supported George Bush. This, as it happened, was true. But both candidates benefited from out-of-state support. The Birmingham News discovered that Hilliard received 87% of his money from outside Alabama, while Davis received 77%. The first thing you do is isolate a community the incumbent had offended, Davis said. The community Hilliard had offended? Jewish Democrats. Hilliard had angered pro-Israel groups all over the country by traveling to Libya in 1997 and by voting against a resolution that condemned Palestinian suicide bombings. Davis's pollster, John Anzalone, said the disenchantment with Hilliard ignited the money that allowed Artur to communicate. He became a congressman by getting the white vote. Whenever I asked Alabamians, whether they were Davis's friend or foe, about what made the difference in the young congressman's election, the response was the same: Jewish money. Southern politics can be incredibly blunt. One flyer that surfaced during the 2000 campaign read, "Davis and the Jews, no good for the Black Belt." Hilliard said he had nothing to do with it. But Hilliard also decided to find a community sensitive to offense. He chose African-Americans suspicious of law enforcement. "The only thing he's ever done for black people is put them in jail," he said of the former federal prosecutor. And just to be safe, Hilliard played the flip side of the law enforcement card as well, asserting in a live television interview that Davis had once been charged with date rape. This, it turned out, was not true. Hilliard did attempt to exploit the advantage of incumbency. Party leaders, including Richard Gephardt and Nancy Pelosi, campaigned for their colleague. Well-known activists, including actor Danny Glover, Martin Luther King III, and Al Sharpton, rallied to his defense. Sharpton, in particular, traveled to Alabama to suggest that Davis was not to be trusted. "The new challenge," he said, "is to try and buy leadership and to have money come in and use people that look like us but that are not for us." He said this at a breakfast rally at the East Birmingham Church of God. "Everybody that is our color is not our kind." Sharpton went on, "It seems there are those who now want to impose their will and call it new black leadership when it is really old leadership with black faces on it. It is more a facelift of manipulation than an example of democracy." "He tried to racialize the contest," Davis said, "and inject religion in the contest. And there was a backlash against that in the final days." Years later, Sharpton told me he got involved in the Alabama race only because he had family members in the state who asked him to lend his weight to Hilliard's cause. But some local Alabama politicians watched such developments with no small measure of disquiet. "Sometimes those of us in leadership positions are so close-minded that we don't include people," said State Representative John Knight, who at 62 years old is a civil rights veteran who once ran for the congressional seat Davis holds. "We don't give them the opportunity," he said. "We do to them what was done to us, that in order to get in, we had to kick the doors down." But Sharpton was not the only one railing at the newcomer. Hilliard's campaign paid for an anti-Davis television ad in which a white man smoking a cigar morphed into a photo of Davis. The voiceover intoned, "A vote for Artur Davis isn't funny, it's an auction." Another voice chimed in, "Sold." Davis won 56% to 44% in 2002, and Hilliard, who was one of only five incumbent congressmen to lose that year, was bitter in defeat. "I see a future with a great deal of conflict between African Americans and Jews in this country," he said. "It's going to get worse before it gets better. I don't think African Americans are going to sit back and let this continue. There will be retribution." In 2007, after being reelected twice, Davis challenged his state's political power brokers once again. This time, he jumped onto the Barack Obama bandwagon early in the race, while the state's African-American old guard Democrats were sticking with Hillary Clinton. When Obama won the Alabama primary and then the party nomination, statewide polls began to show Davis's early bet paying off. By picking the right horse, Davis dramatically enhanced his national profile and his own already semi-declared intention to make a credible run for governor in 2010. "I think what is happening is voters are thinking, wait a minute, if a black can be elected president of the United States, then the idea of a black being elected governor of any state is not so implausible," he told me. Davis, a political junkie who admits he spends more time thinking about these things than he does socializing, though he did become engaged late in 2008, carries the numbers in his head. He figures if he can get 38% of the white vote to complement what he assumes will be a higher, energized black turnout, up to 28% of the overall electorate from 23%, he can pull it off. He has memorized the examples he hopes to emulate. Former Governor L. Douglas Wilder got 39% of the white vote when he broke the color line in Virginia. Former Congressman Harold Ford Jr. got 41% of the white vote in the Senate race in Tennessee, even though he lost. But Davis's task became considerably tougher on the day Barack Obama was elected president. Exit polls showed Obama did drive African-American turnout to 29% of the vote total in Alabama, but he managed only 10% of the white vote in that state, well short of what Davis estimated he needs. I have no doubt if I'm the Democratic nominee, there will be a massive effort saying, if you don't like Obama, you certainly won't like Davis, he said after Obama's dismal showing in Alabama. But my sense is in a statewide race, you have the opportunity to move around in a 2-year period and introduce yourself to voters and tell them who you are and what you're about. Obama was a big part of Davis's formula all along. The two first met at Harvard Law School when the future Illinois senator, then in his 3rd year, gave an orientation talk to Davis's 1st-year class. I firmly believed he was either going to be a Supreme Court justice or a political figure, Davis said years later. The two remained friendly as they pursued separate but similar tracks through private practice, civil rights work, and politics. In 2002, they encountered each other again at a Washington party thrown during the Congressional Black Caucus legislative weekend by Harold Ford Jr., then still a member of Congress from Tennessee. Davis and Obama had just waged campaigns against black incumbents, Davis successfully against Hilliard, and Obama unsuccessfully against Representative Bobby Rush. They were not the most popular people in the room. Barack had run against another CBC member, and we were damaged goods to most of the people in that room, Davis remembers. We ended up standing in the corner, talking about politics. I have a vivid memory of people looking at us and one person pointing to us. I think they were probably thinking, there are the two losers over there. By the time Obama, now a U.S. senator, was poised for his national run, Davis was right there with him as the first lawmaker outside Obama's home state to endorse him. His profile continued to rise when he started appearing as a surrogate on Obama's behalf, taking on the role of the guy who would say things the candidate couldn't. On one such occasion, he appeared on the ABC Sunday News program This Week with George Stephanopoulos with 3 other elected officials. When another black lawmaker, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, said Hillary Clinton was working hard to win over African-American voters, Davis had his riposte ready. I have enormous respect for Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. They've been pioneers of the American South on race, he began in grandiose fashion. Sounds like a butt is coming, Stephanopoulos interrupted, grinning. Indeed there was. They have frankly chipped away and they've eroded their own legacy, Davis said, because this constant talk that says that, well, Senator Obama is not electable. Let's call a spade a spade. Stephanopoulos may not have flinched at the use of the term spade, at least not visibly, but as I watched the exchange on television, I certainly did. Months later, Davis likened Bill Clinton's behavior during the South Carolina primary to, quote, a verbal pat on the head. As Davis progressed on the national stage, he made like-minded friends along the way, including Newark Mayor Cory Booker, who had also run against an entrenched incumbent. Booker agreed to help raise money for the aspiring Alabama congressman. Davis was lucky to end up on the winning side of the argument in 2008. Well before Obama's campaign caught fire, he predicted to me that the time would be right. It is my belief that what has quietly happened in American political life is that white voters have gotten accustomed to seeing blacks in authority positions, he said confidently as he sat behind the immaculate desk in his congressional office in the summer of 2007. Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, and now Barack Obama. So it is no longer a radical event for a white American to contemplate seeing a black person in a serious role. He is counting on the same enlightenment to kick in by 2010 in Alabama. On the night Barack Obama trounced Hillary Clinton in the Alabama primary, Davis was ecstatic. If we can do this, we can do anything we want in the state of Alabama, he crowed at the victory rally. There was reason to be optimistic that primary night. In choosing Obama over Clinton, 56% to 42%, Alabama Democrats decided to follow Davis's lead, spurning the old guard. They got it wrong, Davis said of the mainline Democrats who endorsed Clinton. They misjudged the black community and they misjudged the white community. The man who misjudged the moment the most was Joe Reed, the executive director of the Alabama Education Association and chairman of the Alabama Democratic Conference. Those mild-mannered titles, however, do nothing to capture the power Reed has wielded for decades in Alabama politics. A natty dresser, smooth talker, and consummate master of the inside game, Reed was, for all intents and purposes, the dean of Alabama's black political old guard. This meant most black incumbents owed him their careers, and he was the man to see for any national politician seeking a foothold in Alabama. For Davis to gain his heart's desire to be elected Alabama's governor in 2010, he had to defang Reed, a notion that flew in the face of the way things had been done for decades in Alabama. Reed was the de facto gatekeeper to the black vote for white politicians as well as black ones, and few who challenged him survived to tell the tale. But Davis did. You're not going to have a plebiscite on whether the state is ready, willing, and able to elect a black governor or senator, Davis told me. The election will be about whether you are a stronger candidate or a better candidate than John Jones or Pete Smith. So, instead of running the racial gauntlet, Davis, like Obama, decided to mount his appeal on the bet that he could win votes from whites as well as blacks, the only possible way he could win statewide. It's going to require me going into communities that have not typically had black politicians on the ballot, he said. It's going to require me going into places all around the state and saying, look, I'm not that different from you. That's a tall order in a state such as Alabama, where many voters, white and black, are less than a generation away from a time when segregation was legal and voting restricted. The only African Americans ever elected statewide were a pair of state Supreme Court justices. That may be in part because there are so few black Republicans in what has been a reliably red state. The 2008 Obama-Clinton primary race turned out to be a rematch and a foreshadowing, with Davis on one side and the black establishment on the other. The first time that I publicly said anything about running, people's reaction was, well, that would be a nice thing to do one day, he told me. It was always someday, one day. But the code word was definitely not now. Few challenged the claim that Reed and his powerful Alabama Democratic Conference helped place black elected officials in every chamber of state government. Keep in mind, I was born in 1938 when segregation was legal, Reed told me when we met at a Birmingham restaurant. Some of us are warriors, real warriors, because we had to fight every step of the way to get where we are. Reed is not sure that a generation of politicians born 30 years after he was understands that. But the handwriting has been on the wall for the 70-year-old Reed for some time. Former Birmingham Mayor Richard Arrington split from Reed's Alabama Democratic Conference to form the New South Coalition, which supported Obama. Davis won without Reed's support twice, and then in the spring of 2008, Alabama State University's Board of Trustees, on which Reed served, stripped his name off the campus's 7,400-seat basketball arena. The dispute was not about politics. Reed had sued the board over a personnel matter, but the action served as a symbol of Reed's declining influence. Joe and I, we're old men, said Montgomery State Representative Alvin Holmes, who has known Reed since they were ASU undergraduates. The new generation? Hell, they only know that Martin Luther King made the I Have a Dream speech, and they get a day off for his birthday. They don't know who Ralph Abernathy was, who Fred Shuttlesworth is, who Thurgood Marshall was, let alone who Joe Reed is. By the time the general election rolled around, Holmes had changed his tune. In a pre-election radio ad, he exhorted black voters to go to the polls. For the first time in the history of the United States, we have an opportunity to elect a black president, he fairly shouted as Ray Charles's rendition of America the Beautiful played in the background. So on November the 4th, go to the polls by the thousands. Holmes seemed aware that the old bulls were losing their grip. In his Birmingham News interview, Holmes added, I think sometimes Joe has a hard time with not being the black leader. Reed insists this is not true. Although he takes pride in his role as an old-style Wheeler dealer, he arrived for our summertime interview in a straw fedora and seersucker suit, he claims to be unbothered by the rise of a class of politicians who pay him little mind, if any. Although he supported Hillary Clinton out of loyalty, he said he had no real problem with Obama. I'm going to do everything I can to help Barack Obama, he told me during the summer, and if they don't want me to, that's okay too. His power, he insisted, has not waned. Nobody in his right mind is going to try to run for governor of Alabama as a Democrat without coming to the Democratic organization, Reed boasted. They're just not going to do it. No way. If they want to do it, it's at their own risk. Reed says he would support Davis, but he made clear in our interview that he is open to other offers. They don't even want to wait in line, he complained of ambitious newcomers such as Davis. Their whole thing is, it's mine, and if it's out there, I've got a chance to go after it, and I want it. And if you're old, you ought to get back and let me have it. And if you don't get back, I'll challenge you for it. But Obama ignored Reed's organization and won 85% of the black primary vote. Davis, anxious to make a clean break with the old guard, says he plans to follow suit. Honestly, he told me bluntly, if I was seen as being the ADC candidate, I would not be electable. If I was seen as being the candidate of the black political leadership, I wouldn't be electable. We're not going to spend an inordinate amount of time trying to get endorsements from those groups because it would be counterproductive. But Davis insists he sees promising signs all around him. When Democratic candidates shocked the Republican Party by winning special elections in Louisiana and Mississippi in 2008, Davis was ecstatic. The Republican hold is eroding in the South, he exulted. But just to make sure, Davis was a more conservative Democrat in Washington than his friend Obama was, with a 60% liberal and 40% conservative voting record. Obama was rated 84% liberal, 11% conservative. In a summertime poll Davis's pollsters happily released to the press, the campaign declared that the Obama phenomenon has dramatically changed the way Alabamians view the viability of African-American candidates at the national and state level. With 25% more of those polls saying the state is ready for an African-American governor than had thought so only 6 months before. Davis represents the swath of Cotton States Prairie known as the Black Belt, the fertile, mostly rural farmland stretching from Virginia to Texas that is home to 40% of the nation's black population. It's an area rich in real and fictional connections to America's long conflicts over race. Davis has called it hallowed ground. The small town of Monroeville, Alabama, was home to novelist Harper Lee, who wrote the coming-of-age classic To Kill a Mockingbird. And Selma and its Edmund Pettus Bridge was the site of one of the civil rights movement's historic standoffs, 1965's Bloody Sunday, when hundreds of protesters were clubbed and gassed by local police determined to deny them the right to vote. Well aware of recent history as well as the potential for the future, Davis has invested much of his political capital in convincing outsiders that Alabama is winnable for a Democrat. His political future depends on whether he can persuade fellow Alabamians, only 26% of whom are black, of that fact as well. But then, taking on the black political establishment has already become a defining feature of Davis's political career. At the time Davis defeated the five-term incumbent Hilliard, most black lawmakers were elected from districts where lines were carefully drawn to enhance their chances of victory thanks to a consent decree dictated by the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The Alabama 7th Congressional District, 62% black, was no exception. But Davis created a new blueprint, one that Obama was to mimic on a national scale 6 years later. We were able to reach out to rural whites, rural blacks, suburban blacks, suburban whites, and really put together a biracial coalition, he said shortly after his election. I have a very strong commitment to expanding opportunities for excluded people, whether they are black or white, whether they live in urban areas or rural areas. Does that make me a new leader? It did, and it does. In Washington, Davis set out making a name for himself. In the fall of 2007, he stepped up to the plate at a House Judiciary Committee hearing to grill Justice Department Voting Rights Chief John Tanner. Tanner, a Bush appointee, had been called before the committee to explain to unhappy Democrats how he had come to make a controversial, if not astounding, declaration at a national Latino group's meeting in Los Angeles. Tanner, captured on tape that eventually made its way to YouTube, was trying to explain why he believed voter identification laws would not disenfranchise minority voters in the long term because they would not live long enough to suffer the indignity of being denied the right to vote. Our society is such that minorities don't become elderly the way white people do, he told the audience at a panel discussion. They die first. There are inequities in health care. There are a variety of inequities in this country, and so anything that disproportionately impacts the elderly has the opposite impact on minorities. Just the math. Davis, reaching back to his roots as a federal prosecutor, decided to take issue with Tanner's math in a brutal cross-examination that left Tanner stammering. "Is that accurate?" Davis asked, glaring straight at Tanner. "It was a very clumsy statement," the unfortunate Tanner replied, looking clammy underneath the lights and C-SPAN cameras. Then Davis really bored in. In Alabama, he pointed out, elderly blacks were more likely to vote than elderly whites. "In fact," he continued pointedly, "elderly black people, like most older voters, became more engaged, not less, as they aged. The very idea that they would die before they became disenfranchised was flabbergasting." "Once again, you engaged in an analysis without knowing the numbers," Davis lectured Tanner. "You're a policymaker, sir. You are charged with enforcing the voting rights laws in the country. If you are basing your conclusions on stereotypes rather than facts, then it suggests to some of us that someone else can do this job better than you can." By December, Tanner was gone. Davis also decided to tie his future to the middle by becoming a featured player in the Democratic Leadership Council, an organization of moderate Democrats that launched Bill Clinton's national career and was now the political home of Tennessee's Harold Ford Jr. The middle ground seemed to be the safest place for Southern Democrats in general and for black Southern Democrats in particular, especially if they harbored statewide ambitions. Mainstream values that reflect our best conservative and progressive instincts are what voters chose in the last election, Davis wrote in 2007. For the DLC's now defunct Blueprint magazine, they sensed that a politics based on a rigid liberal-conservative divide is just not adequate to today's challenges. "The most profound moments in politics usually happen unexpectedly," he added. Because he believed this, and as his early support for Obama would demonstrate, Davis left little to chance. In a political soap opera that claimed local and national headlines, Davis also became a featured player in the fight to exonerate former Democratic Governor Donald Siegelman. Siegelman, who was convicted in 2006 of bribery, conspiracy, and obstruction of justice, argued that he was targeted by Republicans, most notably President Bush's political guru, Karl Rove, who directed federal prosecutors to bring him down. Davis became the former governor's point man on Capitol Hill, where the House Judiciary Committee, on which Davis served, convened a series of hearings. Davis became one of Siegelman's chief defenders, even appearing on 60 Minutes to support him. But he also worried that a knee-jerk defense of a convicted politician can smell of the old-fashioned partisan politics he claims to eschew. "When I asked him why he was such a high-profile Siegelman ally, Davis said that as the sole member of the House Judiciary Committee from Alabama, he had no choice but to support an inquiry. Barely know him, barely know him," he said of Siegelman. "He was my governor, he was my nominee. I know him as one politician to another, but remember, he was going as I was coming. We kind of missed each other." Davis said he expected most Alabamians to ignore the complicated Siegelman controversy and was counting on it to fade away well before 2010. Siegelman himself was eventually released pending an appeal. Davis's decision to back Obama fast won him fans in high places, including at the editorial board of the Birmingham News. "Davis was on board early," the editors wrote of his support for Obama. "Davis is not just riding a fast-breaking horse, though. He's also riding a trend in which voters are attracted to youth, vitality, and change. He and Obama represent a new generation of politicians, appealing to a new generation of voters." Still, when people active in Alabama politics are asked whether Davis can be elected governor in 2010, they pause a bit before answering. John Knight, the state representative who has broken with Joe Reed, picked his words carefully when we spoke in his statehouse office. "I would never say it's pie in the sky, and I don't ever criticize somebody for what their ambitions might be," he said. "I think all of us have to have high ambitions, the desire to want to do things, and I admire him for his ambitions and what he is trying to do. But then he added, I would say realistically that this is Alabama. In Washington, older black politicians have been skeptical as well. I think Artur is too intelligent, District of Columbia Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton told me when I broached the idea of Davis running for Alabama governor. Artur can't make himself into a white old boy. I think it would be much more difficult given the state, not for Artur, but the state. Of all states, that's the worst state I could think of now to run in. A terrible state. She added, the country is so polarized, I do not see a Southern governor as our next step, frankly. But Norton said this months before Obama clinched the Democratic nomination, and Davis was counting on the Obama win to be an object lesson for the skeptics. For all kinds of reasons, Obama is not in the position to win this state, Davis admitted to me months before voters even went to the polls. But that does not mean that a moderate black Democrat who ran the right campaign couldn't win in 2010. By mid-2008, Davis had already stashed another $1 million in his campaign war chest, and he regularly dipped into it to salt the coffers of other Democrats around the country. This is a very reliable way to be popular on Capitol Hill. By joining the Democratic Leadership Council, Davis also set out to signal that he was not too liberal for Alabama. Yet, unlike Harold Ford Jr., another black Southerner who tried to walk that partisan tightrope, Davis also forged ties with Washington liberals. One key example, Ford challenged Nancy Pelosi for the House leadership in 2002 to burnish his credentials as a conservative Democrat. 6 years later, Davis chose another tack. He invited Pelosi to Birmingham to speak at the Alabama Democrats' 2008 Jefferson Jackson Day dinner. Some of Davis's political courage could be laid to timing. In neighboring Mississippi, Travis Childers, a white Democrat, had just surprised almost everyone by winning a special election for a House seat long held by Republicans. Add to that Obama's overwhelming Alabama primary win, and Democrats were feeling downright optimistic about the South, when in another year, bringing Pelosi to town would have been akin to inviting a chicken into the wolf's den. Davis counts carefully. In spite of the general election results, he remembers that Obama received 25% of the white primary vote in Alabama. In the short run, Davis's boldness has been rewarded. It is hard to count out a skilled politician who wants the job so badly and one who has the resources that make it impossible for skeptics to turn away. His friends began leading the chorus. I think in a state that saw 80+% of black voters turn out for Obama Tuesday, you'd see 90-95% turn out for Davis, and that would do it, said John Rogers, a black state representative from Birmingham. Davis also knows that his election hinges on how he is seen at home, not necessarily how he is seen in Washington. By championing the concerns of black belt farmers in Washington, Davis hoped to raise his spotty statewide profile, especially in areas such as Huntsville and Mobile, where he was not well known. He did this by concentrating on the things that get members of Congress reelected, such as delivering $3.1 million in federal disaster funds for the state's catfish industry, significantly affected by a drought. Alabama is the nation's second largest producer of catfish. And because the Black Belt is the poorest area of the state, Davis also railed against the lack of education financing in his home state, as well as a regressive tax structure that penalizes the poor. We still tax infant formula and baby food, he says, but yet we have a tax break for animal feed. That's an indefensible posture. Still, there are always tightropes to be negotiated. Taking his cue once again from Obama, Davis has spent as much time focusing on possibilities as on problems. We have stumbled into an array of blessings that for so long a time would have been considered inconceivable, he told a Kiwanis Club meeting in Montgomery. The question is, what do we do now? The question is not whether we have the resources, because we have more resources than ever before. The question is, do we have the commitment, the resolve? But Birmingham Southern's Natalie Davis tried and failed to win her own race for the U.S. Senate in 1996. She is white, and she is not so sure any of this will be enough. In the general election, for a Democrat to beat a Republican, she says, a Democrat has to get about 40% of the white vote. I do not know how you get there. If you're white, I don't know. If you're white, I don't even know how you get there. If you're black, it's that much more difficult. Artur Davis may have taken note of Natalie Davis's electoral difficulties. He decided not to challenge Republican U.S. Senator Jeff Sessions in 2008, even after the Obama primary rout. The Senate race, which he estimated would cost $10 to $14 million, would have been overshadowed by the presidential campaign. Sessions ended up being the state's top vote-getter in 2008. Still, Davis estimated that only 25% of the voting public would cast ballots for or against him because of his race. The only two political coalitions that exist in Alabama, he told me, are the future versus the past. There's been just an equation, which is you have to work harder if you are a Democrat down south because there's a price of admission, said the pollster John Anzalone, who has made something of a career of advising unlikely Southern Democratic challengers. You have to hit a credibility level with white voters, whether you're white or black. In any case, 2010 will not be a vacuum for Davis. In his attempt to win the Democratic nomination for governor, he is likely to face popular former Alabama governor and current lieutenant governor Jim Folsom. Folsom, 59, is the son of a legendary former governor, Big Jim Folsom, and served as governor briefly when, in 1993, he replaced H. Guy Hunt, who'd left office in disgrace. The younger Folsom also has run for office in Alabama a dozen times, including for U.S. Senate and House, so his name recognition is sky high. If Jim Folsom runs, it's going to be a replay of Hillary and Obama, said Natalie Davis. The ties to Folsom in the black community are quite strong. Another Democrat told me the face-off would be a battle royal. One of Folsom's acts as governor was to remove the Confederate flag that flew over the state capitol. Davis began rehearsing his argument against Folsom years in advance, knowing he would have to get past him before a general election challenge against a Republican even became an option. Likely Republican challengers include Greenville businessman Tim James, who has sought the GOP nomination before, Jack Hawkins Jr., the chancellor of Troy State University, Bradley Byrne, the chancellor of the Alabama Community College System, and state treasurer Kay Ivey. Obama or not, Alabama remains a thoroughly red state. Against that uphill backdrop, Davis admits quite readily that he is using the Obama campaign and all it represents to throw down the political gauntlet in a state that otherwise might not have him. One of the reasons I have to be so overt about my ambitions is I can't run a shadow campaign, he told me after leaving church on a Sunday morning where he was repeatedly approached about running. I have to be overt about it because if I didn't make it clear to people that I was interested in running, people wouldn't automatically presume that the black congressman would be interested in running. Davis also tells anyone who will listen that he's not particularly interested in any other job, not lieutenant governor, not attorney general, not cabinet secretary in an Obama administration. I think, Natalie Davis said, Artur wants to make history. Whether he runs for governor or eventually accepts a role in the Obama administration, Davis states bluntly that he does not plan to spend the rest of his career as a member of Congress. The longer you stay in the Congress, you will accumulate more difficult votes, you will accumulate more difficult positions that may be hard to reconcile with your national base or your local base, he told me, speaking with more political candor than most lawmakers allow themselves. That will get worse over time. The longer you remain in the Congress, the more you become the part of the backdrop, the more you become a long-term congressman. If you're in the Congress 15 years, people say, you've been there for 15 years. Why not stay 20? Ultimately, I think we can run a campaign that just doesn't get too tied down to the anchor of race, he said. Race is going to be a topic of conversation, but we're not going to get bogged down in these internecine fights among black political leaders. Chapter 6, Legacy Politics. A political career is just like any other career. Plumbers' sons become plumbers. Politicians' sons and daughters become politicians. The odds of you going into politics if your parents are in politics are much greater. David Basaitis.
Context of white supremacy. That will do it for the first audio segment. We'll pick up, we'll basically be at the beginning of Chapter 6, Legacy Politics. That's where we'll pick up for the beginning of Chapter 6, again, Context of White Supremacy. If folks would like to chime in to share their thoughts on the first section of the reading, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Information, additional information, since we just concluded the chapter on Artur Davis, one of the black males representing the breakthrough that she's writing about. Mr. Davis did run for governor in Alabama in 2010, and he did not win. In fact, he lost in the Democratic primary, so he did not get very far in his attempt to become the first black governor of the state of Alabama. He eventually switched to the Republican Party a few years after his 2010 loss in Alabama. Most recently in 2015, he tried to become the mayor of Montgomery, Alabama, and he lost that bid as well. So that's some of the additional information that's happened with Mr. Artur Davis since the publication of this book. Anywho, if you do not want to use your phone to dial in, if you want to use the free vote line, you can do so as well. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinytiny.cc/oneRace, and that is the number one. The address again, tinytiny.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. When you put that address in, there should be a link on the left of the page that says free vote line. Click it. It will open a small window on your screen. The top line, it's a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can use a real name if you want to use a nickname, if you just want to press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It should connect you to the live program. You should be able to hear us live. It's the same procedure if you would like to participate. Once you connect yourself, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. You'll hear an audio prompt. Press the number 1. We will get you on the line, and you can share your thoughts and views. We are about halfway through the book. I know for some folks, they've said this is not exactly medical apartheid, but I am learning a few things. So regardless of how you feel about it, we're about halfway done. So we are moving briskly. Folks who dialed in, let's see, the caller at 5771. Did you have comments here you wanted to share? You should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the listeners. In the chapter ending in regards to the gender politics, Lynn had cited a study about why not enough black women were in politics, and I guess the study said that there was a lack of political ambition, which is kind of vague to me, so didn't understand what they were talking about when they said that. I got a question. In the beginning of the chapter of the Arturo Davis, the park that they were in, did they say that there was a statue of somebody being attacked by a dog? Is that correct?
Let's see. Beginning of Artur Davis. Statue. Okay, so we have on a sizzling day in downtown Birmingham, Artur Davis is strolling through the heart of the 4-acre Kelly Ingram Park. I think it's the statues of when the black people were being attacked in Birmingham in the 1960s. They have statues of, that's what it is. It was not the statue was being attacked. It's a statue showing when black people were being attacked by the dogs. They have this.
Now, that right there is very, very questionable to me. You know, I mean, it's very weird that they would have statues of black people getting attacked, because typically in the history of art, I'm not an art expert, but statues are supposed to, you know, resemble some sort of pride and dignity. And they have a statue of black people being attacked by dogs. And it's just very confusing to me on why they would allow that, you know, or why would anybody allow that? I don't know if it's just, white people's, love of, you know, seeing black people being attacked, you know, but, you know, who knows? As you see with the campaign between Hilliard and Davis, you know, politics seem to bring out the worst in anti-black behavior, you know, with them going at each other, and then you get Al Sharpton involved, and you know, people who don't even live in Alabama being involved in that whole campaign. And there's, you know, basically a lot of black, you know, with Sharpton being the main, you know, antagonizer, you know. So politics seems to bring out the worst in anti-black behavior. I'm a little disappointed with, in the chapter gender, she didn't mention anything with Cynthia McKinney. So seeing if, you know, she mentions her somewhere in the book afterwards. So was a little disappointed in her not being mentioned in that chapter. And I vividly remember the Barack Obama being trounced by Bobby Rush in the late 90s in regards to the congressman race, because, you know, Barack Obama was a relative unknown at that time. And, you know, a lot of people still figuring out, you know, how did he become president when he couldn't even beat Bobby Rush, you know, in a representative race. So that was a interesting flashback there. That's all I have, and I'll leave my line.
Appreciate that. If other folks have commentary they would like to share, feel free. Please do not wait till the last minute if you think you have commentary you would like to share. Some of the notes that I took in the chapter, I will say that throughout the week there's a lot of footage available of Gwen Ifill. She spent so much time broadcasting and just her career as a journalist. They have just lots and lots, hours and hours of archival footage if you want to check out. And a lot of her presentations dealt with race. Racism. So you can check out some of her career and see other things that she had to say. I will say, for some of the footage that I watched, specifically talking about this book, I've said she, you know, obviously she covered Hurricane Katrina and a lot of other things dealing specifically with racism, but everything that I've been watching has been about this book. They have been challenging to view, listen to, because I just think a lot of the information is not accurate. And again, the timing, I don't, if I had read this book in 2009, I think it still would have been difficult, because I didn't, my opinion about, you know, President Obama hasn't really changed from the time that this book was written in 2009, January of 2009, to right now on the wake of the Trump presidency. That white people are in charge. Apparently they wanted him to be there for two terms for whatever purposes. And now we're moving on to Donald Trump. That's the way that I assess things. Racist man, racist woman were in charge when he got there, and they're still in charge 8 years later. That's the assessment that I have. So it would have still been challenging for me to read this book in 2009, just because of the all of the optimism and we did it and this interracial coalition got together and we got, I never thought that that was the case. That was not my assessment then. And it seems to me even more laughable now that Trump, presumably you would have had a good chunk of these whites. They supported Trump this time around, not Obama. They've even interviewed some of the folks who made that switch. But particularly now, it's like, wow, extra tough to read this one. I mean, all I can say is we just stand by our work. If I had said, Mitt Romney is going to win in 2012, I stand by my work. If I had said John McCain was going to win in 2008, I stand by my work. If you think President Obama is representing multiracial coalition and the end of race being a factor, or certainly not being as central a factor as it once was, we stand by that. And I think it's helpful because it's okay. Well, we get to see what things were correct and what things were not. That's the way that I'm viewing this, even though it is mighty tough, but that's the way that I'm reading this. I will get in one more note and then I'll get Lashes to get some of her commentary. I'll get in one more note that stood out to me from this week's section. Let's see. The beginning, I thought it was interesting, some of the commentary from Shirley Chisholm. They've been talking about her a little bit over the course of the election as well, where she said the harshest discrimination I have encountered in the political arena is anti-feminism, both from males and brainwashed Uncle Tom females. I thought that was, I've never heard Uncle Tom used in that manner to berate someone for being misogynist or sexist. She went on to say, Shirley Chisholm, when I first announced I was running for Congress, both males and females advised me, as they had when I ran for New York State Legislature, to go back to teaching a woman's vocation and leave the politics to men. And she presents a lot of different voices throughout the text, both white and non-white, who say the same line, that they had a tougher time with feminism, that that's a significantly larger problem than racism. The only thing that I say is I come back to the statistic, and this is from last week in the text. This was something that I didn't touch on last week, but it's in the same chapter. And what she said was that for people who were having this debate about which was the bigger problem, she said, which really helped or hurt more, race or gender? In exit poll after exit poll during the primaries, voters who said race mattered voted against Obama, while voters who said gender mattered voted for Clinton. That, I think, is extremely telling for a myriad of reasons. And I just think that consistently, there's a lot of confusion when we bring the gender aspect in. It really, the view that I've seen, one of the major things it does, it moves white women out of the category of being thought of as a racist white supremacist. They become victims of patriarchy. It just becomes, it's all white men doing this. I think that is totally inaccurate, and you eliminate about half of the racists. They're no longer racist now. They're victims. We're seeing white women as suffering some form of brutality on all of this, like Hillary Clinton. That's one. And I think, two, it grossly misrepresents what's happening, where we end up talking and speaking as though you have black males that are in some position of power, that they're the ones keeping Hillary Clinton down and making it so they can't get these positions, or they're the ones, black males, have some sort of power to keep Shirley Chisholm from being able to run. And I just haven't seen that to be true, that black males are in a position to dominate and make decisions about what's going to happen for themselves or anybody else on this planet. And I compound that, I just go right back to the text with Gwen Ifill from this week, the quote that I just read, that was from last week right at the end, but it's all the same chapter, the race-gender clash, where if I'm saying, sexism is the bigger problem, right, because they had a lot of people who said that in the text, where you come back and then you say that it's about, she had specific details, I'm just trying to flip forward through my highlights here, where she has specific details about the numbers of black, there it is. There has been documented improvement. The Department of Education reports that more than two-thirds of all bachelor's degrees earned by African Americans are awarded to women, a number that rises for master's degrees. That's what I mean. People can say whatever they want. I can come on here and say whatever I want. I can say that Gus is just the most handsome, intelligent, dashing, courageous voice in the history of, I could come out and say that, but I mean, at the end of the day, like, you can say that, and then we go and we look at the evidence to see, is that true? Does the evidence support that? The evidence in your own text doesn't even support what has been said over and over and over. And I'm reminded of the conversations we had earlier this month about black male privilege, or I guess that was right at the end of November. I'm reminded of that. Dr. Curry responded, and he said, the stat or the information, the position that was taken that white women make less money than black males, that is false. He said that about as vehemently as possible. And then he supported with the evidence, the statistics from the U.S. Department of Labor, that white women make more money than both black males and black females on average. So I'm reminded of those conversations. I reject that in total. The problem is white people, the system of racism, white supremacy, black males, black females. We're at the bottom of the boat, and whites strategically, effectively employ, in my view, bringing in sexism to just confuse our understanding of what white supremacy, racism is, how it works. Lashie, did you have commentary you were going to add as well?
I wanted to talk more about intergenerational difference between the party, but I'll wait until the next talk go around.
Okay. How interesting.
That was highlighted last study session as well, but I wanted to discuss that, so I'll hold off on the sexism part.
Okay. That seems like it would have fit now, because that was a big part of what she talked about this week and last week, the generational.
Okay, great. Yeah, okay. Great. So what I noticed with the DNC in this election and hearing the book study session on this particular topic of intergenerational, like, conflict, it's amazing how these parties continue to repeat the same political behavior over and over again, selling it to the public as something different when it's the same old. And anytime a younger politician, for example, Barack Obama in this time period, they weren't supportive of him because he was an outsider from an age generation perspective. And once he started getting support by whites, other blacks began to circle around him as well. But you're also seeing that now played out in the sense of the DNC, since they lost so badly. And between the black guy who wants to run for the chair of the DNC and this other Latino that's running for the chair of the DNC as well. But the difference between those two is that the Latino is a insider, you could say part of the generational clan of the DNC, where the black guy, I think he's like a Muslim guy from Minnesota or something like that.
Keith Ellison.
He's not in the generational high-class clique, so to speak. So this is still playing out regardless. That's all.
They've been doing a lot of talking about some of his previous commentary and connections to Louis Farrakhan, who was also mentioned in this book, and he has not been willing to come out and, or I don't know, maybe he has, maybe I missed that part, but I know he was on Democracy Now! Within the last 2 weeks talking about this, and that's been a big to-do in whether or not he can get this position or not, some of his previous remarks related to racism, which, as you said, we just keep doing the same things over and over again. If you're a black person, we'll require you to rebuke or renounce or reject specific black people or black people in total. That will be required publicly somewhere along the way. And if you do not do it to our satisfaction, then maybe we will not allow you to, you know, progress in your political development. If other folks have commentary, feel free if you want to respond to some of the issues that have been brought up, or if you have other thoughts from the book you wanted to touch on. I touch on this metaphors consistently. There are a lot of them in the book where, sandpaper conflict, where she used that term regularly in the book, more so than the term racism. Another one where she says, this is in the Artur Davis chapter, where she says, let me give the full context. She says, bus boycotts and church bombings were by then hallmarks of the nation's ugly past, but the echoes of segregation still lived on, even in Davis's own story. Just when we use terms like that, when we're talking about an ongoing current system of terrorism, I think that generates confusion. I think a lot of times racists, they do a great job of encouraging us to think of racism, white supremacy, as being something from, you know, 1,000 years ago, slavery, or way, way long, 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 long time ago. Certainly nobody is practicing racism, white supremacy now, or if it is, it's echoes, whatever that means, which is just nonsense. We should really reject that way of thinking about articulating racism, white supremacy. Also, I asked previously in these study sessions, I asked who people think the audience, the intended audience for this book was, and I think Roz and some others said that they think this book is written for black people. They think this book is written for black people and to maybe corrupt the way that black people think about racism, white supremacy, so that they're not thinking about this problem correctly, not even thinking about whites correctly, since this book is strongly positing that you have a sizable number of white people potentially who are done with racism and they are willing and able, ready to vote for a black person. Ha, ha, ha. That's one of the, to me it seems, that's one of the major themes from the book. And I, as I said, I had been watching videos from the time that she was out on the book tour for this. This was a bestseller, so she did a lot of talks, went to a lot of places, colleges, what have you, public forums. The talks that I've seen where they show the audience, it was way dominant white people. That doesn't mean that, you know, it couldn't have been a sizable, maybe even the majority of the people that bought the book or read the book were black people. But at the talks, it's been like super white. Like it's been maybe, from my recollection, I would say it's been at least 70% white, and I think probably higher than that, but at least 70% white when she was going out doing talks about this book. Let's see. Some of the other things. The next portion when Artur Davis, when he's coming in and he thinks he's going to run for Congress and get Mr. Hilliard, Earl Hilliard, get his congressional seat, where he says part of Hilliard's vulnerability arose from redrawn district lines that moved him away from his base of support, adding more white voters to his district. Part of it came from the fact that Davis had a lot more money to spend the second time around, courting just those white voters. He raised and spent nearly $1 million. I thought this was so important for many, many reasons, and kind of why I've said I feel like so much of this book, at least the early portion that we've read, I guess we've read about 40% of the book now, so much of it to me seems focused on like black people squabbling with other black people. Like, you know, Jesse Jackson not supporting President Obama, or some of these other black figures where they had John Lewis, where they had an allegiance to the Clintons, and black people, I guess, like Artur Davis, who early on were supporting President Obama and that sort of thing. And I just, in the scheme of things, I'm not saying it's not important, but it's not the most important. Like the white people that have the power to redraw these lines, I think that is way more important. Not saying, you know, that there's no value to what's being presented. I think a lot of times we end up focusing and placing greater significance on squabbles and small conflicts between victims as opposed to paying to the people that are responsible for all of this, white people. Also, the first caller who mentioned Cynthia McKinney and why she was not included in this book, that right there would be, bam, great follow-up, because that is exactly, not necessarily redistricting, but having all of this out-of-state money, particularly white people specifically, who we do not want this black person in office anymore. We do not want this person in the congressional seat anymore. She was a six-time congresswoman in Georgia, Cynthia McKinney. We don't want her to have this seat anymore, so we'll just pool money and even hot party, because they have open primaries in Georgia. And so you had all of these white people that were not Democrats coming in and voting in the Democratic primary to make sure that Cynthia McKinney did not win a seventh term. That would have been a great spot to fit it in. And this was not ancient history. This was within 10 years of when this book was written. I think she didn't include that, or at least my theory would be, because that does not fit the mold of the breakthrough that she was discussing. I'm sure she was very informed about what happened with Cynthia McKinney, Gwen Ifill was, but that just doesn't fit in this book. If the premise of this book is that things are improving so much that white people are willing to vote for a black person and race is becoming less significant for a lot of black people, what do I say about it? I mean, I don't, how do you even make sense of that? That contradicts everything. That contradicts the main point of the book. Unless I'm totally misreading this, that could be the case, but that just seems like something, there's no way that could fit in this book. We'll have to pay attention. I'll get in one more note and then see if anybody else has other comments that they want to get in. People could be out doing their Christmas shopping, or people could just be uninterested in following through with the breakthrough, Gwen Ifill. Let's see, one other thing that stood out. When she talked about Obama winning 10% of the vote in Alabama, this is 2008, when they had the general election in November, he wins 10% of the vote. Again, when you have a number like that, that's something that, in my view, it should not be glossed over as we're talking, you know, in a very Pollyanna way that Artur Davis can pull this off. He can make it happen. He can run this conservative Democratic campaign. As I said, he eventually became a Republican. He can do this. He can appeal to whites. He can offer them trust. He can do all of those things, and maybe they'll support, or maybe he can get enough of them that he could still win. Clearly not the case. He couldn't even get enough votes, white votes, to get past the Democratic primary. And I just think that we have a tendency to do this, and this might have been the type of thing where some white people said, hey, this is the type of book that we want. Sometimes I think that happens as well, where non-white people, this is your assignment. You're not picking cotton today. You're going to write this book, and it's going to be what we want said about racism. And we'll approve it, and if you do a good job, hey, we'll make it a bestseller and book tour whole nine. That's what. And if you don't do a good job, or you're acting like you don't want to do it, well, you know, maybe you don't get to keep that anchor position. I'm sure they could do it either way, so I keep that in mind as well. But just that sort of thing should not be minimized. President Obama, most white people did not vote for him in 2008. Most white people did not vote for him in 2012. In fact, Donald Trump got more white voters this year than President Obama did either time. That, I think, is the big story in terms of really understanding what it means to be white and the centrality of white supremacy racism. Did folks have any other comments they want to get in? We miss anybody? Or Lashes, Mail Caller, you all have anything else you wanted to share? I would assume they are satisfied. If anybody, the chapter four. Oh, right on. Appreciate it. If anyone had commentary on the race-gender chapter, that was chapter four, because we ended that. She's moving on to other topics as we're rolling through the book. You should go ahead and get that in now. If you disagree, or if Gus is not, again, Gus is not making sense, you should share. I did say on the Facebook page, it is profound reading this at this moment, particularly given some of the information she shared last week about the conduct of white women in the 2008 the primary, really, is what she's talking about, and coming out and saying this, you know, this Negro President Obama is not qualified. He wouldn't be there. Hillary Clinton should have this spot, and just going on and on and on. Black males were able to vote before Gloria Steinem saying this. Black males were able to vote before white women. Sexism is the biggest scourge, and just going on and on and on. It is amazing to get that information in just being, you know, a couple weeks removed from 53% of white women voting for Donald Trump. That should be front and center, and in my view, it should be one of those things where we are not surprised. We should be getting to the point where we are not surprised at the conduct behavior of white women. They can come out and selectively choose to say, well, feminism is a problem, sexism is a problem, even though they don't go out and support black female victims like Daniel Holtzclaw's victims in Oklahoma. Convicted serial rapist, sexual terrorist. White women weren't jumping up and down and making sure that that got mainstream coverage, but they can whine and complain when they feel they are not being able to flex and exercise their full power and authority as white supremacists. They can do that selectively, and they even fool a lot of us victims in that. I think it's great at this moment to be reading that. And even recently, I tied back. We played last Saturday on the compensatory call-in. Ta-Nehisi Coates, who we've also read in the book study, he did an interview on NPR with a host that I think is a white woman, Rachel Martin. She asked him to comment about 8% of black voters supporting Trump, and he just brilliantly flipped the question to say, well, I mean, over 90% of black voters did not support Donald Trump. That speaks much larger than the 8%. You almost never get a demographic to vote 90% in support of one person. I think that tells you more about what black people thought about Donald Trump. In my view, the total evisceration that she deserved, and further, for this to be, I think, a white woman, what about the 53% of white heifers like you that went out and supported Donald Trump? That's where the focus should be. I thought he was such a sexist and a pig and everything that he said. I see the same thing in this text. It could be tied together nicely, the conduct of white women consistently, how they behave, and the white supremacist interests that guides their behavior when it comes to presidential elections. That's something right there. You can make a nice little connection. Let's see. Anything else? Yes,
quick question. Do you think the DNC has learned a valuable lesson of not putting up a white female against a white male who has lots of machismo and represents RWS much more clearly than the white female?
I mean, I think it's situational. I mean, I think they could vary. If the U.S. had a Marine Le Pen, I think she could roll. Absolutely. They could put her up if they could manufacture someone like that. I think if you're supposed to be a Democrat, I think the conventional mold, at least what it's been over the last 50 years or so, they have been the party that I guess most people perceive as being the not racist. They're supposed to be a bit more refined about it. Depending on how they want to govern the system of white supremacy, I think they absolutely could put a female candidate forward, just changing the messaging and what it's going to be. I don't think Hillary Clinton would be viable, but I certainly think they could find someone. If we're talking 2020, I certainly think they could use a female candidate. I don't know if you meant white specifically or just female in general, but I certainly think they could have a female candidate, white or non-white, to say, hey, this is going to be the person that's going to run to replace Trump. They certainly could get a racist female candidate. I certainly think that would be in the realm of possibility. I just think at this particular moment, I think was very specific for why they wanted to use Donald Trump, if that makes sense.
Got it. So to my understanding, they used Donald Trump, DNC that has used Donald Trump as their opponent, thinking it would ensure them more votes, but actually backfired on them. With Hillary Clinton as the main face of the Democrat winner.
That's interesting. I'll have to ponder on that for a moment. The caller 1842, did you have commentary you were going to share as well, 1842?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
There were a couple of points that that just kind of stuck out to me in this reading. I'll make them really quick. Actually, can you hold like 2 seconds?
2 seconds. I think we can manage.
Thank you so much. Okay, I'm back. Yeah, I apologize about that. When it comes to speaking about the so-called intersectionality of race and gender oppression, I just think it's a moot point personally, because black males don't have the power to influence global anything, or anything for themselves for that matter. So I agree with you on that. One thing that I thought was really interesting about that is that early in the beginning of the reading, she talks about how white women do not have to worry about whether or not they can have children and run for office. And to me, that's just like amazing. You know, there were two women, one in particular, she was 38, and she said, well, I'm 38, I just got married, and I can't do it all. But white women, like, there's no break, or like, people don't look at that as like, well, you can't be white, female, a politician, and a mother. And I think the underlying thing, like how racism was worked, a lot of people just expect that white women have the resources to have nannies. Like, white women have nannies. And whether or not we're saying it or not, I think that that's something. A black female who is attempting to enter into politics may not be able to afford this nanny or this, someone to come and help them raise the kids. And it wasn't stated, but I thought that was so interesting because it's like, well, yeah, white women can do that. She's not actually doing it. She's not actually cooking and cleaning and taking care of the children. She's paying probably a black person to do it. So she can still have her career, just like as a slight interjection. That was something I didn't even realize was very widespread. This is 1842. I'm in D.C., so when I would, like, do a lot of networking, white women all the time talk about, they call them au pairs now, and they bring women from other parts of the world, and they don't have to pay them much at all. They just, the women want to come over here because they're like, if I can get here, then I can learn English and I can maybe go to school and stuff like that. So these women don't get paid. There are agencies to do this, to, you know, match families, and you interview them and all that. And the female lives in their house and does everything, like runs all their errands, cooks for them, cleans for them, like does everything. So these women, these white women, are able to have their careers. And to me, it's just kind of sad. Like, if there was anything that's, like, unfortunate about being black and female outside of the fact that you're black, is that, and all that that means is, like, sometimes we are having to choose between having careers and having families, because, like, something is going to fall. Like, we can't just do it all. So, anyway. And then as I was listening, I realized that the term racism is not used, but race is. Like, it's always the race problem, or race is an issue, or we need to talk about race, or however it's being used. And I feel like that is a manipulation tactic to say that it's race, race being just like this thing, like just the fact that I'm black or this person is white. When the distinction is made between race and racism, then racism, like if you use racism, that focuses on it being a system, that focuses on it being an intentional system to keep all non-white people, specifically black people, out of certain areas, or just, you know, just all that racism is. And so I was paying attention to that because and it was quotes that used it, but she used it as well, just race, 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 and not racism. And it's like a slight thing, but it does something, at least I could feel it in my own mind as I'm listening, that when we talk about race, like if we just say race, that's not the same as talking about racism. And so, you know, I don't really know Gwyneth. It's not like I never followed her work. I can tell that she is confused. But I've been learning some things. It's a little hard for me. I'll just say this in case there are other people who are listening who might have the same thing. I am having a little difficulty following because there's so many people I don't know. I'm like, who is this person? Is she talking about a white person? Is this person black? Like, I need to look at all the, like, Google them and see their faces and their names, because I'm completely ignorant in who these people are. So right now they're just like a bunch of names being thrown around, but it's good to hear them because it makes me a little bit more informed. I do agree that so much of the book does seem about focusing on the tension and, you know, conflict between black people in politics. But it's good that way I can actually see. Well, I mean, to me, what I'm realizing is if you want to be famous, you want to be somebody, you want people to listen to you, I mean, all you have to do is talk negatively about other black people or incite conflict between black people, and you're halfway there pretty much. So that's my contribution for the first half. Thank you.
Radiant. Caller at 3637. Did you have commentary?
Hello, everyone. I just wanted to say I just started listening when you all were talking, so I didn't listen to the first half. But Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough, that being the name of the book, and The Breakthrough supposed to have something to do with politics, I just don't see how she is making that comparison as black people being in politics and that being some type of a breakthrough. And I'll mute my line.
The person, retired firefighter in Florida, did you have commentary?
Greetings, everyone. My thoughts, first of all, I'd just like to qualify my thoughts by saying I'm with what is assumed to be the popular meaning of politics. I'm not really good at. That's why I like the idea of adopting Mr. Fuller's meaning, which is relations between people, you know, keeping it simple, and it has a broader context, perceivably a global context of relations between people, as opposed to what I've been hearing. You know, it seems to be, you know, kind of complex, and at the same time, a lot of figures and numbers and that sort of thing, and that basically, in my opinion, is staying within the ground rules that are laid down by white people who practice racism, and unfortunately, a lot of non-white black people just to get a job, a quote-unquote high-profile job, and be able to stay in it, they have to become very versed in that if they're going to stay in those positions. And I suspect that the author was one of those non-white black people. And so therefore, what you have this charade of black people, if we do this and we do that, and we get coached along by white people who are more refined. They call themselves white liberals. Some people call them white liberals also. Being coached by them, just keep on, black people, keep on doing it, and you'll get there. And a lot of us actually are very much persuaded by this particular context, as opposed to looking at things from a global standpoint and understanding that we're under a global context of racism, white supremacy, and there really is no such thing as the reality of anyone practicing America at all. And so this is what I'm hearing, you know, as far as that concern within the text. And it can be quite confusing in a sense, unless you stay focused on the global system of racism, white supremacy. And that's basically what I've been hearing as far as that concern, and that's basically all I have to say right now.
Appreciate that. Absolutely, global context of racism, white supremacy. Some of the quick notes I wanted to make sure I got in. I feel like I can be pretty aggressive in my critique of this book because I have been paying attention and, you know, I am taking it seriously. I think the same thing. I appreciate 1842's comments. There are a lot of people in this book. I didn't know a whole lot of details about Artur Davis and some of the other people that we're going to be learning about. Like, I didn't know a lot of the details about white women, Gloria Steinem, and these folks. Come out of Alice Walker, who's non-white female. She, that is a cowbell, though. But Alice Walker coming out and talking about lamenting her white female, the racism of her white female friends,
when President Obama won the Democratic nomination in 2008. I am learning things, but the overall point, you know, the book is not accurate about racism, white supremacy. I can still learn things having an accurate understanding as I go through the book, and I am taking that opportunity. But the overall point, it's not accurate, and I can be pretty aggressive because, as we've went through, we've had lines like Artura Davis saying, Davis was, or her, Gwen Ifill writing about Artura Davis, he was likely to end up on the winning side. He was lucky to end up on the winning side of the argument in 2008, well before Obama's campaign caught fire. Davis predicted to me that the time would be right. It is my belief what has quietly happened in American political life is that white voters have gotten accustomed to seeing blacks in authority positions. That right there is hilarious. 2016, and you can just go ahead and stamp that for 2017 on to infinity, unless I'm mistaken. I have seen no indication that white people are comfortable. They are all good about having black people in positions of power, even as the post office worker. They are disgruntled. I see that all the time. Next. I think, I don't remember who it was. Someone last week said that it might have been 1842, said that at times when she is like mimicking, and Gwen Ifill is narrating, so at times when she mimics other people, it at least they gave pause because it seemed like she was voicing black people differently than she was white people. It seemed like there was no doing a fake or some sort of impersonation when she was quoting or taking the persona of a white person, and it came up again this week when she's talking about Mr. Who is this? I'm just trying to get all my names correct here. So Mr. Holmes, Alvin Holmes, he goes on the radio to support President Obama. He had been a Clinton supporter at first. He's in Alabama. He switches his mind, and she did like a voicing when he's on the radio. And so, you know, for the first time in history of the United States, we have an opportunity to elect. But she, it was noticeable, and the thought came to me again because she hadn't done that for white people. Where Alvin Holmes seemed aware that the old bulls were losing their grip, had a Dr. Welsing moment, and even that phrasing to be referring to black politicians or black civic leaders as old bulls, that gives me pause. The black leader, all of the black leaders are white. I said that last week. another gem why I say this book, it's laughably inaccurate. Like I said, this book has not aged well at all. Davis insists he sees promising signs all around him when Democratic candidates shocked the Republican Party by winning special elections in Louisiana and Mississippi in 2008. Davis was ecstatic. The Republican hold is eroding in the South. Mr. Davis is now part of the Republican Party. It's laughable. Another gem. In a summertime poll, Davis pollsters happily released to the press, the campaign declared that the Obama phenomenon has dramatically changed the way Alabamians view the viability of African-American candidates at the national and state level. President Obama won 10% of the white votes in Alabama in 2008. I'd have to look at the statistics, but I'm pretty sure Trump won Alabama this year. That in and of itself says everything that need be said. This is another one. This will be my last point that I get out, unless anybody has anything that they want to get in. We can migrate to the second audio segment. Well, I do need to say something about the Jews part as well. But this portion, she's still talking about Artura Davis in Alabama. Davis represents the swath of cotton states, prairie known as the Black Belt, the fertile, mostly rural farmland stretching from Virginia to Texas that is home to 40% of the nation's black population. It is an area rich in real and fictional connections to America's long conflicts over race. That's another one of those, because those are all Gwen Ifill's words, no quotes. Conflict over race at 1842 again, and it said, it's in the title. The title doesn't say racism, it says race. And she says that frequently, conflicts over race. Once again, this is not, you know, the Hatfields and McCoys just having a little argument. And in fact, I made a note, the audio segment that we began with today, that was from her 2009 interview with David Brooks on C-SPAN. They were talking about her book. This was, I think, like a day after the inauguration when they did this interview. So, I mean, it was really, really extra Pollyanna and optimistic and, oh, life is just as great as can possibly be. But she says, she says she was talking about racial conflict that President Obama, that he was able to be successful. And it's that same optimism, the same change. And she says that we were able to get past the sense of racial tension, tension between the races. That's the phrase she used. Tension between the races, again, not racism, where you're going to make me feel guilty about what my ancestors have done to you, that you're going to make me give you affirmative action and no one else. Those were the two examples that she gave as examples of tension between the races. And I just thought that to me signals this is about white people. Yes, it's going to confuse non-white people, but this is directed at white audiences. To even make a phrase like that, where I, as a black female and a highly melanated black female, and taking the perspective of white people, that the essence or the best two examples that I can give of this country's history of tension between the races is white people, me feeling aggrieved about my ancestors being accused of mistreating someone, or me being forced to give you affirmative action. Those are the examples of racial tension. Amazing. The inaccuracies abound. I'll stop there. Did anybody have anything they wanted to get in before we get to the second audio clip? Everyone is satisfied? Nothing? Anyone needed to get in before we get to the second audio clip? You had your chance. You can take a note if you want to get to it after the second audio segment ends. We should have time there. So we're picking up. We're right at the beginning of Chapter 6. So we have moved on. We're done with Artur Davis. And so now Chapter 6. It's not flipped. Why is it? I don't understand. All right. Well, it's not letting me chip. There we go. So this is Legacy Politics, Chapter 6, Legacy Politics, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Inheriting power is nothing new in American politics. The nation's second and sixth presidents were father and son, as were its 41st and 43rd. In fact, the nation's political history is peppered with the names of grand political families, up to and including the Adamses, Tafts, Bushes, and Gores. But African Americans, who did not get the fully protected right to vote until the mid-1960s, have only recently begun to establish enduring political legacies. Across the country, these bloodline power grids are beginning to take hold. Stepping up, the Jacksons. Jesse Jackson Jr. is standing dead center in the rotunda under the ornate dome of the U.S. Capitol. His arm is extended straight above his head, and he is spinning around in a circle. This is no dance. He is in full congressman mode, down to his tailored suit and polished black shoes. But he has a point to make, emphatically, as Jacksons tend to do. When you walk into the Capitol Rotunda by the stairs and look around, from Christopher Columbus all the way around to the Wright brothers is something called the Story of America, he says, pointing out the painted frieze that encircles the room 58 feet above the heads of the tourists. The 19 images start with Christopher Columbus and end with the birth of aviation. Jackson exclaims to me, "There is not a single African American in the entire Story of America," to the Wright brothers. He's told this story many times before, but Jesse Jackson Jr. is still outraged. Rushing over to nearby Statuary Hall, he expounds some more. There are 100 statues, everyone from Ethan Allen to George Washington to Huey Long. There is not one black face. The younger Jackson has found his cause. He has helped engineer the decision to bring a statue of civil rights icon Rosa Parks to the hall, and along with white conservative Tennessee Republican Representative Zach Womp, co-sponsored legislation to rename a portion of the new Capitol Visitor Center Emancipation Hall. He has come a long way from his first days in politics, playing factotum for his father, Jesse Jackson Sr., during the Elder Jackson's 1988 run for president. He is now a seven-term member of Congress, published author, and father of two. His wife, Sandy, joined the family business in 2007, running and winning a seat as a Chicago City Alderwoman. So, Junior, as others call him, has emerged from his father's shadow, right? Not quite. Jesse Jackson Jr., one of five children, says he has been giving a lot of thought to what he terms the continuum of black politics, something his father speaks about as well. But while the father thinks back to the arc of a movement that started in the 1950s, the son is more focused on saving black folk from the sins of their fathers. There's a movement in the black community toward accountable leadership, the younger Jackson told me, as we sat in his congressional offices one rainy Washington morning. The paradigm for the unaccountable leaders has radically shifted, he said. I consider very respectfully, and this is for the record, my father to be part of the unaccountable leadership, even though I completely believe in and trust his mission and his motives for that which he does. But the press conference, television visibility, lack of follow-through, everything is a civil rights issue paradigm with leadership is profoundly unaccountable to the masses of people and to history. Remarkable words coming from the son of the man who practically invented the Everything is a Civil Rights Issue campaign. Don't get him wrong, Junior continues. There is a place for the agitation and protest politics of a Jesse Jackson Sr. and an Al Sharpton, but it is not here, not now. The elder Jackson is keenly aware of his son's apostasy. I encourage in our house vigorous debate, and there is no punishment for a different point of view, he told me. We have different roles. Jackson Sr. is the agitator. The younger one is the negotiator. Even though both father and son endorsed fellow Chicagoan Barack Obama's 2008 campaign for president, they viewed Obama's candidacy through fundamentally different lenses. At one point, during the height of the presidential primary campaign, they took their disagreement to the pages of the Chicago Sun-Times. The Democratic candidates, the elder Jackson wrote, have virtually ignored the plight of African Americans in this country. Jackson Jr. responded immediately, penning his own op-ed under a headline that read, Jesse Jr. to Jesse Sr., you're wrong on Obama, Dad. While causing quite a stir, Jackson's comments unfortunately dimmed rather than directed light on the facts, the younger Jackson wrote about his father. Obama, he argued, represents, quote, powerful, consistent, and effective advocacy for African Americans. The father-son split was put on dramatically wider view later in the campaign when, as we've seen, the elder Jackson was caught on camera whispering into an open microphone that he was so angry that Obama was talking down to black people that he wanted to rip his nuts off. Jackson Sr. quickly apologized, and Obama shrugged off the criticism and crude language, but not before Jackson Jr. declared himself deeply outraged and disappointed in his father's off-the-cuff remarks, which he also denounced as ugly rhetoric and reckless. It is a rare thing to see a family political dispute aired so publicly, but the split in the Jackson family was irresistible in that it mirrored a more general split within the community at large. Senator Ted Kennedy and his niece Caroline cast their lot with Barack Obama, while another niece and nephew, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., opted for Clinton. Similarly, Congressional Sister Act Linda and Loretta Sanchez in California split their primary choices, with one, Linda, supporting Obama, and the other, Loretta, Clinton. But within the African-American community, such splits cut much more deeply, in part because most had never had reason to disagree before. If Jesse makes certain moves, if he needs to distinguish his own name and reputation from mine, I understand that, the elder Jackson said, noting his son's insider responsibilities and mixed-race constituency. I see the gist, the transition, what his options are now. Where he's hugging them in 08, I was putting them out in 72. He laughed. I find joy in that. Congressman Jackson's effort to get out of his father's shadow was put most eloquently on display at the 2008 Democratic National Convention. It was in this venue that Jackson Sr. in 1984 gave perhaps his most memorable national speech as the delegates in San Francisco cheered his refrain, "Our time has come." 24 years later, he was not even offered a speaking role. Instead, the son took center stage. "I grew up in the lessons of another generation, the Selma generation, my father's generation," the younger Jackson told the crowd in Denver. "I know his stories of struggle and sacrifice, of fear and division. I know America is still a place where dreams are too often deferred and opportunities too often denied." The Selma generation, he did not have to say, represents the past. "I know for the sake of our children, for the sake of our families, and the future we hold in common, he is the leader we need right now," Congressman Jackson said of Obama. His father supported Obama, too, but the elder Jackson sees the history differently. And given the opportunity, he can catalog every breakthrough along the way because he was often present for the big victories as well as the small humiliations. He remembers the night in 1967 when he joined Martin Luther King Jr., Ralph Abernathy, and Andrew Young for a trip to Cleveland to celebrate the election of that city's first black mayor. The group gathered in a hotel suite, awaiting their summons to join the victor on stage in the ballroom downstairs. The call never came. "As I've said to my son and others, what does one generation owe the other?" Jackson told me after retelling the story of the 40-year-old election night insult. "Remember, be grateful, and do well. Remember, because sometimes you have to go back over the same path." The Harlem Renaissance, the Pattersons. David Patterson got his first taste of politics on the back of a sound truck wending its way through Harlem. As the truck mounted with speakers moved through the streets of America's most famous black neighborhood, the 16-year-old bellowed into the microphone, urging residents to vote for his father. "I tried to make my voice deeper to create the illusion that I was older," he remembers now. It was 1970, and Basil A. Patterson, then a member of the New York State Senate and later Secretary of State, was running for lieutenant governor on the doomed Democratic ticket with gubernatorial nominee Arthur Goldberg, a former Supreme Court justice and United Nations ambassador. They were easily beaten by Republican Nelson Rockefeller. If they had won, Patterson would have become New York State's first black lieutenant governor. His son was watching carefully, and decades later was still able to recount the events of that year in sports play-by-play fashion. Interestingly enough, he wins the primary, he gets 71% of the vote, he wins every county in the state except the home county of the person he ran against, Patterson said. "Here's an African American winning in these heavily white areas overwhelmingly, so this is shocking. But when the general election comes, his likeness never appears in any ads for governor. They don't use him at all." The younger Patterson smelled a squandered opportunity and took careful note of the fact that no one seemed to give his father credit for the strengths he brought to the ticket. Lessons learned in that race informed a critical decision the son made 36 years later. That's when David, by now the minority leader of the New York State Senate and a mere two seats away from claiming the powerful majority leader's post, decided to join Elliot Spitzer on the Democratic ticket for governor as lieutenant governor. Democrats thought he was crazy, but Patterson was reliving his father's past. "I wonder if the reason I ran for lieutenant governor was not just because I thought Elliot Spitzer was going to really be a super reformer and I wanted to be on the team, but that part of it was me wanting to avenge the loss," he told me. On election night in 2006, when it was Patterson's turn at the microphone, he reveled in the notion that he had attained the brass ring his father had deserved but not gotten. "I said to the audience that I've never compared myself to my dad," he told me. "I've never seen myself as a replacement for him. I'm just a closer." He was more skilled than that. David Patterson learned names, faces, and the ways of electoral politics at the knee of the city's most skilled practitioners, his dad, Congressman Charles Rangel, Manhattan Borough President Percy Sutton, and Mayor David Dinkins. Basil Patterson worked the levers of power in New York State for decades. He served as Ed Koch's deputy mayor and as Governor Hugh Carey's Secretary of State. He was an insider's insider in New York City politics. "I'm a Harlem guy," Basil said when asked to compare his style to his son's. born here, grew up here. I knew a lot of people, some people that I don't admit I knew anymore. So we're different that way. Yet I know if I walked down the street with my son long before he became governor or lieutenant governor, everybody knew him. I always came home and talked about what I was doing, he told me. I couldn't help myself. Legally blind after a childhood infection robbed him of sight in one eye and severely limited his vision in the other, David Patterson grew up on Long Island and never ran with the political pack. He took up the family business only after exploring careers in the law and journalism. But everything he did learn about politics happened in Harlem. To be honest, my father never said to me, "I expect you to take the reins, son," or that kind of thing, the governor told me. It was almost like an effect of your identity. His father remembers it the same way. I'm not sure this is something that I wanted him to do as much as he saw it as a thing he wanted to do. The governor says he was first drawn to the idea of a political career at the age of 10, as he watched Robert Kennedy speak at the 1964 Democratic National Convention. Watching another family's legacy play out on a public stage resonated. He was following in the footsteps of John. Hillary follows in the footsteps of Bill, said the governor, who supported his home state senator in the 2008 Democratic primary. So I always relate to that kind of family member who has to deal with that shadow. With his father as his guide, Patterson became a keen observer and practitioner of Black political leadership. There is always this discussion of who is the leader, he told me. Is it Jesse Jackson? Is it Reverend Al Sharpton? The question isn't who's the leader. The question is how badly we need them. If you lived in Scarsdale in New York, who cares who the leader is? Everybody's doing great. What do you need a leader for? Ultimately, David proved his own leadership skills by building a 23-year power base representing Harlem in the state Senate before he moved on to the lieutenant governor's job. And through a quirk of fate and political misfortune, in less than 2 years, the younger Patterson became the state's first African-American governor. No one was more surprised than he was, his father chortled. Patterson stepped into the job in 2008 after Spitzer was implicated in a seamy scandal in which it was revealed he had paid high-priced prostitutes to service him in a Washington hotel. Patterson's rise may have appeared sudden, but it was not out of the blue. He had spent more than 2 decades as a blind man learning the political ins and outs of Albany, listening to voices and detecting intentions. He even had to memorize his speeches. People think he just got there, but he worked hard for a long time, his father said tartly. Black folks, whenever we get there, it's like it was overnight. It didn't matter how long we worked for it. At the age of 54, David Patterson was only the nation's fourth Black governor. Virginia's L. Douglas Wilder and Massachusetts' Deval Patrick had preceded him. A more obscure chief executive, Pinckney Benton Stewart Pinchback, rose from lieutenant governor to Louisiana's top job for 5 weeks in 1872 and 1873, after the governor he was serving was impeached. Patterson and Patrick have compared notes about the difficulty of being a governor and a representative of the larger Black community. The New York governor is particularly annoyed at what he considers to be coded judgments aimed at him. In an address to the NAACP annual convention in 2008, he complained that he is frequently referred to as the state's accidental governor because he was not elected to the job. We counted 27 references to the accidental governor that were reserved just for me, Patterson told me, the trace of irritation still in his voice weeks later. And my question is, why is that going on? Most of the time, though, Patterson took the edge off uncomfortable situations with a joke or an easygoing smile. On the day Patterson was sworn in, he was greeted with applause as he arrived in the Capitol's red room. If most of you weren't being paid, I'd be flattered by that, he said, and everyone laughed. But weirdly, on the very next day after he took office, Patterson and his wife Michelle stepped before the cameras in Albany again, this time to admit that they had been unfaithful to each other, he with multiple partners. The disclosure echoed loudly, a jarring aftershock to the Spitzer scandal. But those initial scandals faded as Patterson set about negotiating the thicket of state government. At about the time he was settling in at the governor's office in Albany, the state's economy hit the skids as the global financial crisis that froze the national economy hit the Empire State's budget hard. Taxes derived from Wall Street businesses typically provided one-fifth of the state's revenue. Patterson shaved the state budget by $1.5 billion his first summer in office, and by October was faced with begging the state legislature for help in closing a $1.5 billion deficit. None of this could be learned at Daddy's knee. But politics could. In 2008, the nation's newest black governor remained loyal to his home state senator during the primary election and remained so even as Barack Obama steadily made his way toward the Democratic nomination. Once Clinton conceded, Patterson embraced Obama with the understanding that, in many ways, both men were playing the same game, trying to meet expectations and tests that never face white candidates. In my short time, and I know I'm just sipping at what Barack Obama has to go through gallons of every day, Patterson told me, the energy that takes away from your effort is immense. The Tennessee Waltz, the Fords. Harold Ford Jr. is a son of Tennessee, but like former Vice President Al Gore, he really grew up in the rarefied confines of Washington, D.C., as the privileged son of a member of Congress. He went to private schools and spent his time off working on Capitol Hill as a congressional page and an intern. As he approached his final year at the University of Michigan Law School, Ford Jr. began thinking about taking a year off to work in Bill Clinton's White House. So he sat down with his father, who held the congressional seat representing Memphis, and had a little talk. Dad, it turns out, had a plan to make sure young Harold got that law degree. If Harold Jr. finished at Michigan, his father would retire from Congress. His son could replace him. And true to the terms of their deal, when graduation approached, the younger Ford phoned his father. He called me up and said, "Look, are you going to step down?" Ford Sr. told me, and I said, "I'll keep my promise. Are you ready to run?" The promise counted for a lot. Harold Jr. was in school out of state and was only technically a Memphis resident. But the Ford name would help erase any carpetbagger accusations. With the help of campaign signs that simply read Jr. and a campaign strategy that got the 26-year-old invited to as many hometown elementary school graduations as he could wangle, he won. "You never know when an opportunity will present itself," Ford said years later in a speech to the University of Arkansas's Clinton School of Public Service in Little Rock. "In the strangest, weirdest of circumstances, out of defeat, out of turmoil, out of just difficulty, you never know when an opportunity may lurk." "My dad was one of 15, Ford told the students. "I cannot imagine not having running water. I can't imagine some of the things my dad did not have. They worked hard to make things better for me." Together, the two Fords held the Memphis seat for 32 years. The elder Ford had broken through thanks to education, collecting degrees from Tennessee State University and Howard University. With his newly acquired expertise in mortuary science, he worked at building a family funeral home business that allowed the Fords to establish deep roots and loyalties within Memphis's black community. He was elected to the Tennessee House of Representatives in 1971. Harold Jr., taking advantage of those roots and the seat his father essentially handed off to him, headed to Washington for 5 terms as a member of the House. By 2006, he was ready for a change and launched what would become an $11 million run for the Senate. But Ford discovered that the family ties that had gotten him elected to Congress could be a real disadvantage in a statewide race. The Ford family's by now formidable reputation in Tennessee ranged from heartfelt support in mostly black Memphis to hardwired suspicion in mostly white East Tennessee. Republican nominee Bob Corker, although a well-connected former Chattanooga mayor himself, was able to brand young Harold as part of the, quote, Ford family machine. There were indeed a lot of Fords involved in politics. When Harold Sr. defeated an incumbent Republican to win a congressional seat in the post-Watergate election year of 1974, he did so by only 574 votes. On that same night, one brother, John, won a state Senate seat, and another, Emmett, clinched a state House election. But there was a stain. Over the years, several Fords had also endured tangles with the law. 4 Ford brothers were each indicted at one point or another on various fraud and bribery charges. 2 were convicted and 2 acquitted. Edmund Ford Sr. in May 2008 and Harold Ford Sr. in 1993, after being accused and tried twice. Furious members of the Congressional Black Caucus said Harold Ford was unfairly targeted, calling it a classic example of the continued harassment of black elected officials. Still, the cloud continued to hover. Just before Harold Jr. announced his Senate candidacy, his uncle John was indicted on wire fraud charges, for which he was later convicted and sentenced to 14 years in prison. Those were to be served consecutively after he completed another 5.5-year sentence on a bribery conviction. Sometimes the problem wasn't alleged criminality, but embarrassment. In 2008, father and son were forced to establish arm's-length distance once again, this time from Harold Jr.'s two brothers, Jake and Isaac, who chose the 40th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s Memphis assassination to make racially charged remarks about Representative Steve Cohen, the white man who had succeeded the Fords in the majority black 9th congressional district. I asked the younger Harold about family baggage when he was running in 2006. It was a question he had become accustomed to. "I am who I am," he replied, "and I think voters know my opponent has made clear to everybody that I'm black, that my family is big and political, and sometimes finds itself in a newspaper for things for which they didn't do. But I can't do anything about that but be me." For his part, the elder Ford does not think the family issues cost his son the U.S. Senate election. Instead, he believes Republicans beat his son at the money game, sending millions of dollars into the state to help Corker pay for weeks of withering television ads. One that became instantly notorious claimed Harold Jr. frequented Playboy clubs and featured a buxom blonde who whispered at the end, "Harold, call me." Corker denounced the ad, which was paid for by an outside independent group, but he still profited from it. With one stroke, the ads managed to remind voters that Ford was black, read, "not like you and me," and at the time, unmarried, read, "not like you and me," and to hint that he was engaged in miscegenation, read, "not like you and me." They ran the race card on him, the elder Ford said, and he just couldn't overcome it in the last couple of days. By Election Day, everyone in Tennessee was convinced Ford would lose, but by much more than he did. Ford won 95% of the black vote and 40% of the white vote. But if voters lied about their preferences, it helped him. He got 48% of the vote overall, a closer margin than the 12-point loss pre-election polls had predicted. Still, a loss is a loss. Harold Jr. disagrees with his father on what brought this to pass. He says his party affiliation hurt him more than his race. But there is some evidence that, in this case, father knows best. In that same election year, Phil Bredesen, a white Democrat, rolled up overwhelming majorities in his race for governor, sweeping every county. A third of those Bredesen supporters, however, declined to vote for Ford. "It hurt," Harold Jr. later admitted. "It was the first time I ever lost anything." Still, Ford had done something brand new for a black candidate running in the South. He appealed to white voters by shedding the liberal label, denouncing same-sex marriage, labeling himself pro-life, and even filming one campaign ad in a church. In conservative East Tennessee, I saw him run into traffic to shake white voters' hands. He engaged one young man in a sidewalk conversation so penetrating and intense that the voter came away leaning toward voting for Ford. The man told me later he'd never voted for a Democrat in his life. Democrats have to be willing to meet people where people are and meet their lives where their lives are. And don't be ashamed to talk about the things that we care about, Ford said sometime later. We need to cross the hurdle on national security and fiscal restraint, and we need to demonstrate that our values are consistent with other people's values, that they are mainstream not only in Arkansas and Mississippi and Tennessee, but around the country. 2 years later, in an open letter published in Newsweek, Ford urged Obama to run as he had. "People know that the candidates running for president don't live just the way they live," Ford wrote, "but they want to know that they're understood and that their daily struggles are respected." Ford remains adamant that straddles like these are essential for the new breed of African-American politician. I bring a little bit of a different orientation to it, he told interviewer Charlie Rose early in the 2008 primary process. I'm a member of the National Rifle Association, although that's not something that my party fully embraces yet. Not even his father fully embraces that, but neither man seems particularly concerned about their occasional differences. You can have disagreements with father's son, Harold Sr. said, noting the public split within the Jesse Jackson family. Harold Jr. and I were extremely close, but that's not to say we agree on everything. I respect his positions and he respects mine, and we talk about it a lot. But the two are still more alike than different. If you notice my record in the Congress, I was really a middle-of-the-road type guy, said the elder Ford, who now works as a lobbyist. Other more liberal members of the Congressional Black Caucus, he said, viewed him with suspicion. The younger Ford, too, became suspect in some liberal circles when he agreed to become chairman of the middle-of-the-road Democratic Leadership Council. The DLC has made it their mission to separate the word liberal from the word Democrat. Jesse Jackson Sr. often dismissively derided the group as the Democratic leisure class. Ford, however, decided the DLC represented the Democrats' future. We can achieve the progressive ideals of the party, Ford said in 2003. But only if we campaign and govern like the innovators of our party's proud past. As head of the DLC, Harold Ford Jr. now travels the country defending Democrats and Republicans alike. The reason Harold Ford likes me so much, perpetually endangered Connecticut Republican Christopher Shays once said, is because when I realized that I wasn't going to be president, I went up to him and told him that he was one of the three legislators that I thought would someday. Shays, however, won't be in Congress to help. He was defeated in 2008. The DLC has devolved into something of a spent political force in the years since the election of one of its own, Bill Clinton, to the White House in 1992. Since then, it has become a refuge of sorts for the party's most conservative members, and certainly for its Southerners. Its annual meeting, which once hosted top candidates every year, failed in both 2007 and 2008, to attract either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. The snub was particularly apparent in 2008 when the group met in Chicago. The Illinois senator, by then the party's putative nominee, was actually in his hometown that day, but didn't bother to drop by. Speculation continues to swirl that Ford, married now and spending the bulk of his time in New York as a vice chairman for Merrill Lynch and a television commentator, might return to politics. He has continued to keep a hand in, teaching at the LBJ School at the University of Texas in Austin and at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. His name still surfaces regularly in Tennessee commentary as a potential candidate for the 2010 gubernatorial race, but his prospects remain unclear. As a columnist for the Nashville City Paper warned, another loss would mean the end to a very promising career. In fact, Ford is keeping his Tennessee connections intact. He told the Little Rock audience that when he is in Memphis, he stays at his condominium and regularly gets up in the morning to run a route that takes him past the National Civil Rights Museum on the site of the Lorraine Motel where Martin Luther King Jr. was shot. I do think we've made enormous progress, and I think we can all appreciate that, he said. And then I look up at the balcony and think we've got a long way to go. And then, he added, I look back up and think I have not done nearly enough to try to make the kind of difference that I know that all of us are capable of making. His father's advice? I hope he stays on Wall Street and makes a little money. The loyal son, the Clays. William Lacy Clay Jr. freely admits that he won his first political office because his father's name was William Lacy Clay Sr. This was not his plan, in part because he grew up in a household where his father always seemed to be off somewhere else, picketing, getting arrested, agitating. Politics was not his goal. To be honest with you, when I was growing up, I hated politics, Clay, now a member of Congress from Missouri, said. I hated what it did to people. But after he struggled through high school and college to finally land at Howard University School of Law, he was presented with a slam-dunk chance to win election to the Missouri State Legislature. His father, by then something of a kingmaker in St. Louis politics, was on the hunt for someone to fill a vacant statehouse seat. His son, who at the time was still living in Maryland, where he had essentially grown up, volunteered for the job. His main qualification? He had the right name. A mere 6 weeks later, he was on his way to Jefferson City. By the time Bill Clay Sr. gave up his congressional seat 17 years later, the younger Clay, known as Lacey to differentiate himself from his dad, had established a reputation and a name of his own. When he arrived in Washington to take over his father's seat in 2000, Nancy Pelosi swore him in. Standing nearby, his father teared up. Bill Clay Sr. was a member of the first wave of decades-long members of the Congressional Black Caucus. He got elected the old-fashioned way, climbing up through St. Louis ward politics and defeating 7 white and 4 black competitors along the way. One of the white candidates owned a Howard Johnson's restaurant, where Clay was once arrested while trying to get served. His breakthrough came in 1968, the same year New York's Shirley Chisholm and Ohio's Lewis Stokes were sent to Congress. He would remain in Congress for 32 years. The three of us, Stokes, Chisholm, and I, came to Washington determined to seize the moment, to fight for justice, to raise issues too long ignored and too little debated, Clay wrote in his 1992 book on Blacks in Congress. We were described by the media as militant, aggressive new leaders, determined to make changes in the way black members of Congress had been viewed in the past. Clay and the others promptly created the Congressional Black Caucus and set about rattling the status quo on Capitol Hill and ultimately in the Nixon White House. They went to war with Nixon over everything, from the creation of a Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday to programs for low-income housing and other Great Society anti-poverty programs. Father and son bear a striking physical resemblance to each other, and their liberal politics are nearly indistinguishable. But Lacey Clay is the first to admit he lacks some of his father's considerable street political skills. He remembers faces, but not always names. In St. Louis, people sometimes refer to me as the milder version of my father, Lacey Clay says. But he was not that mild. He once kicked a group of labor leaders who backed another candidate out of his office after they showed up with a list of demands, even though they hadn't supported him. His father, with his close ties to organized labor, never would have done that. He also resists the kingmaker label his father enjoyed for so many years. I had an 80-year-old guy tell me, "You're a congressman. You can do anything," he remembers, chuckling at the thought. I said, "Look, pal, I only know one person that ever walked on water, okay?" But when the 2008 presidential campaign was threatening to devolve into a political death match between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, Clay did not hesitate to throw down the gauntlet and cast his lot with the growing chorus of Obama supporters who tried to force Clinton out of the race. "If you have any kind of loyalty to the Democratic Party," he told Clinton, "perhaps you need to rethink your strategy and bow out gracefully in order to save this party from a disastrous end in November." The son was told repeatedly that he would have trouble filling his father's big shoes. His response was to tell his critics they were absolutely right. "I said, I'm never going to be him because he was the first African-American legislator from Missouri," Lacey Clay said. "He was the first this and that. I won't be the trailblazer that he was because he's done it all. He's laid a path for me." Lacey Clay is now a fully entrenched member of the Congressional Black Caucus, an inheritor of a safe seat in a majority black district, and an admirer of the lions of the civil rights movement who preceded him. He listens carefully to the critique of younger activists and politicians who declare it time for a new approach to black politics, and to some extent, he counts himself among their number. "I think we have deference to that, to the previous generation," he told me as we sat in his congressional office, surrounded by the photographs and framed newspaper articles linking him to his father. "We have a profound respect for them, and we know, most of us know, and realize how we got here. It was on the shoulders of them. They paved the way for us to make it to these new heights. Look what they did, the Lou Stokeses, Bill Clays, John Conyerses, and the Charlie Rangels and the Adam Clayton Powells," he said. "I don't know if any of us would have had the will or the strength to do all of that." But the battles are different now, Black lawmakers couldn't even get a haircut on Capitol Hill when they first came to Congress. Their sons and daughters are struggling instead to alter the agendas they have inherited. Lacey Clay remembers having a tough conversation with his father when he tried to explain why he supported charter schools to supplement public education. The two had to agree to disagree. As simple as the politics of inheritance may seem, Clay was only the second African-American member of Congress to step into a parent's shoes. Harold Ford Jr. preceded him. Kendrick Meek followed.
Context of white supremacy. That will wrap us up for this week. We will be back next week. Again, we're at the halfway point, so there should be like three more sessions, and we will be all done. We'll pick up next week. We'll still be in Chapter 6, kind of the midway point for Chapter 6. But tune in next week. If you have comments you would like to share, the number again is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. And just, I guess, the point that was made about the caller said, I think it was 1842, she said she didn't really know a lot of the names that are being mentioned, not knowing these people, not knowing what they look like, not knowing if they are white or non-white. It, I think, is important, just kind of in going through this, two things that jumped out at me. So at least for some of the main figures that we have had mentioned in the book thus far, obviously President Obama, let's see who else we had in the book thus far, Cory Booker, Cory Booker has already been mentioned, but there's a whole chapter on Cory Booker coming down the road. Harold Ford Jr., well, I thought it didn't hear. All right, so that's Harold Ford Jr. It's man, it's stunning. The more that you know about these people and seeing, oh, so Harold Ford Jr. is married to a white person. Oh, I see. Very interesting. And President Obama has a white parent. Ah, very interesting. It is remarkable once you start seeing some of the patterns. Oh, Cory Booker also has a white parent. And even phenotypically, seeing, you know, the people that we are talking about, at least some of the people that we've heard already, President Obama, U.S. Senator Cory Booker, Harold Ford Jr., former congressman, a lot of these, even Lacey Clay that we just heard about, a lot of these folks are very, very pale. Like, they are all about the same complexion as President Obama. Nobody here is like the skin complexion of Lupita Nyong'o, nothing even close. Very, very pale-looking non-white people, and more than one actually with a white parent, more than one actually in some sort of sexual tragic arrangement with a white female. That is also important to know as we are listening to this book about all these breakthrough politicians. Any of the folks who dialed in with a hand up, do you all have any comments you wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Let's get 1842.
Just really quick, I won't take too much time, but I'm actually happy that you mentioned that because one of the things, I didn't actually get a chance to look them up, so I didn't know what they looked like, but when I was listening, it just came above me. I was like, all of this, these are all folks who are just about ambition, and it could be the way that she's telling their story, but I don't even think it's that. Like, just based off of some of the things that they're saying, none of these people are interested in actually doing something. Well, in part, they don't have a proper definition of racism, white supremacy, but they're not even talking about racism. They're not even racism. They're not talking about black people. They're not, like, no one is passionate, even how they talk about it. This is really all a bunch of ambitious people who want to be somebody. And that's just what they're doing. And they are privileged in whatever way. Like, and when I say that, I mean that they grew up and went to good schools or whatever it is. And it really stuck out with me with the last person. I think it might have been Ford. Was like, I'm not even trying to do this, but I have the right name, so I'll just do it. And then one, because he had the right name. I mean, for me, it's frustrating because, like, I don't know a lot about politics, so I don't really haven't been paying attention to know that. I just know, of course, there are black people in Congress and such and whatever, but come to find out that their parents were, and so they were just able to move in. And this kind of ties into, like, sometimes when other black people see other black people doing really, really well, and they feel bad because they don't, like, they didn't go to school, or they're not traveling the world, or they don't have this. And I'm always telling black people, like, you really don't know. Anyone and everyone is going to say, oh, they did it on their own. But the truth is they could really have mommy and daddy. They could have a trust fund. They could have money set aside. They could have won a lawsuit, but they're not going to tell you that. But anyway, so, like, one thing that, like, a pattern of behavior that I was paying attention to on how racism works, it was in the Ford piece. I don't know who he was running against, but there was an ad. At the end of the ad, the white woman whispers, call me. The person, the Republican, I'm assuming, says, denounced the ad, but still benefited from the ad. Fast forward to now, you have Trump, who is denouncing quote-unquote alt-right or whatever, but he's totally benefiting from it. Just to kind of pinpoint, like, that's how racism works. Like, the unified understanding that we all, whatever understanding that they have, and they just do their independent parts, and it all works together because it maintains their system. There, again, she said the brass ring. I wonder, Gus, it'd be awesome if you could tell me how many times she mentions this brass ring. That'd be fantastic. But anywho, and then I thought it just tacky, not coming at Miss Eiffel or anything, but the whole dynamic between the Jackson conflict and then she says that it was not common to see this kind of, like, political conflict. And I was like, right, whites would know better not to do that. You know, they could disagree all they want to, but not in front of the people. We're not going to be like that, you know, and talk bad about each other and say, well, you were just ineffective. And to come, like, I don't know any of them, but I didn't even know that the Jackson son was even doing anything. So if the father was ineffective, I maintain that probably so the son is, because I didn't ever even know you were doing anything. And so, again, the book is difficult. I'm learning a lot, though. And I appreciate that a lot. And but that whole and then whites are benefiting from this, like, black political nepotism, because they know that the fruit don't fall too far from the tree. So if the father or whomever it was wasn't that effective, then you're, you know, addressing racism, like, it's likely that the children are going to be even milder. And the last politician that we heard from was pretty much saying that, like, my father was more revolutionary or aggressive than I am. And so I think whites benefit from this, whereas, like, you would think you wouldn't necessarily want it to be just like a family, because, like, a snowball effect, like, you would grow and then you'd get smarter and you would want to do more and be more effective. But it seems to be the opposite when it comes to black politicians. And I think that whites are very happy to say, well, hey, yeah, we'll just replace you with your son because, you know, he was around us. We know him. We know he's not going to do anything. He or she, excuse me, whatever. But anywho, I enjoyed the second part a little bit more. I'm learning a lot. Thank you.
For sure. The brass ring is mentioned in the book 4 times. We're going to hear it once more before the end. And it was William Lacy Clay who said that he got into politics just because of his name, that his father was also in politics. William Lacy Clay said that. Retired firefighter, were you going to comment, sir?
Yes, sir. First, I'd like to qualify what I say, that I am a victim of racism, white supremacy, and I am kind of slow. But I am slowly figuring out this book and its pattern. What it appears to do is, like, speaking about individual achievements of non-white black people primarily through the white supremacist understanding and persuasion of the word politics. And I'm thinking to myself, what a waste of our time and energy, all of this and what I'm hearing. She probably does a very good job at reporting this, but in retrospect of that, my mind keeps telling me over and over again that it's a tremendous amount of waste of time and energy that she's talking about, and I see presently that we are involved in. When you're talking about a non-white black person, let's say even if they do, quote unquote, get this office, we don't have any power globally and in this part of the world to make white people do anything at all. If we achieve this position, but I took some notes and I'm just going to quickly go over them. There was some talk about a statue in the beginning of the second reading, and what it struck in my mind was in a new museum in Washington, D.C., the largest, according to Dr. Johnson, Umar Johnson, the largest statue in that museum itself is one of Thomas Jefferson, who we all know was a rapist and a white supremacist. Number two, I see no benefit in reporting conflict between black people, specifically the Jacksons, at all, as far as that concerned. But I can understand if someone can be entertained by that, which is most unfortunate because we, in our confused status, we do get entertained by the shenanigans or the incorrect situations that black people find themselves in, and some of them happen to be relatives, and it becomes interesting. There are television programs that support what I just said. Number three, jotted down, and I'm probably repeating myself. I'm hearing more of the illusion of equality to white people is as the theme, and I have down here a play that's instituted primarily by very refined white people. A lot of times they're called liberals, that sort of thing. That kind of like pushes us along, albeit they know that things are predicated on a global system of racism and white supremacy. I mean, we're hearing all of this talk about the quote unquote leader of the place is called Russia, and the next president of this part of the world, and that tells you of a global context of racism and white supremacy. While we sitting around here and worrying about who's the next a governor of the state of Georgia or something like that. Number four that I have down here, the only black leader, and I think I heard someone else say this, the only black leader is a white person, which is logically true under the system of race and white supremacy. And last but not least, I have down here the whole practice of victims of racism thinking that the vote will solve the problem of racism, white supremacy, is highly venomous to our counter-racist efforts. To a large part, it's a waste of our time and energy. I have down here, and I have in parentheses, which is time and energy, is the meaning of it is it's come under the people activity of economics. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Any of our other callers, Lashes, the caller 5771, did you all have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The previous callers basically echoed the same thing that I was probably going to say and reemphasize, because I think I mentioned this in the first session about anti-black behavior within each other, and to me, it's very prevalent in politics. You know, the Jesse Jackson Jr. and Jesse Jackson Sr. debate, you know, within the Chicago Sun-Times was just an example of that. And what's so ironic about it is overstatement that Jesse Jackson Sr. that I thought was practically true when he said that the Democratic Party has done nothing for black people. And I can't argue with him on that one. So, that's a very interesting one. I know in the last session last week, I'm hearing the term civil rights being interchangeably used with racial or racism. There was a statement that somebody said about Jesse Jackson Sr. about him saying that everything is a civil rights issue. And it can also, that sound like it could be equated to everything is a racial issue or a racist issue. So I remember last week they were kind of interchanging civil rights era with post-racial era, that type of terminology. So that's a pretty interesting language that they're using there. That's about it for now. I'll mute my line.
Right on. Anybody else? Lashes, did you have anything else you wanted to get in? Are you satisfied?
I just wanted to say that basically this entire blacks supporting the DNC is just a complete farce. Don't bother. Period.
No support for the DNC, that's it?
Pretty much. They're about the status quo and no progression, no progressive this, nothing. It's just a complete farce. It's all rhetoric, period. You have a softer, milder version of white supremacy with DNC, and you have a more overt, in-your-face style, nostalgia version of white supremacy with the Republican Party. It's just, what a complete farce. Both, it's just a farce altogether.
Farce, yes. And just the point I was making earlier when you asked the question about a female candidate, it wasn't even always that way in terms of, it used to be the reverse. It used to be that the Democrats were the party of Benjamin Pitchfork Tillman, and just, make it flagrant that we're about white supremacy, and the Republicans were, the great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln. So, they could conceivably flip it around again if they wanted to or whatever else. But at the end of the day, it is racism, white supremacy, period, after you get past the rhetoric. Some of the things that stood out when they started the chapter with, man, you talk about crack up laughing. So they start this chapter. We ended the last segment with Artur Davis, the Democratic breakthrougher who eventually lost, didn't even make it past the primary to get the governor spot in Alabama. And now he's a Republican. He's not even a Democrat anymore. And just most recently lost his run for mayor of Montgomery, Alabama. Then we start with Jesse Jackson Jr., who has not been out of confinement too long after he was convicted, I think, of inappropriate use of funds while he was in Congress. It's painful just reading this. Like I said, this book has not aged well. But when she starts off with him being in the rotunda by the stairs and look around from Christopher Columbus all the way around, and it's that this guy's a terrorist. It's not just that you don't have any black figures, statues, paintings, whatever he wanted, symbols. It's that we are worshiping race soldiers. That would be a greater issue. We have flagrant terrorists that are being worshipped, which is rampant throughout the system of white supremacy. My man Ben Tillman, statues still up, multiple in South Carolina. Dr. J. Marion Sims from Medical Apartheid, statues still up in New York, Alabama, and South Carolina. Moving forward, there's a movement in the black community towards accountable leadership. Man, I was howling. This coming from Jesse Jackson Jr. White people, they make sure. Generally, it takes some muscle to, quote unquote, hold people accountable. You do this or you do that, and, I disagree with it or think you shouldn't have done it. I have some, ability to make you sorry, make you wish that you hadn't done that, and maybe think twice before you do it again. And I haven't seen where black people have that sort of muscle, even to hold other black people, quote unquote, accountable. But I was cracking up laughing when Jesse Jackson Jr., before he was convicted, was talking about the move to hold leadership accountable, whatever that means, just howling with laughter. As I said, that's exactly, you can just replay what I said last week, common rhetoric. I thought it was fascinating talking about the, even when she was talking about generational divide, when she's talking about Jesse Jackson Jr. and Jesse Jackson Sr., and I thought 1842 spoke to that well. I think you have a lot of black people who disagree. I've said that consistently. There is no black monolith. I'm sure Gwen Ifill would agree, but I see a lot of black people who are in the same age group, the same age sometimes, who vehemently disagree about many things. So I don't even know if that is as big a deal. I just, the same pattern, like I said, of you know, getting down and focusing on all these little conflicts and squabbles amongst black people and really minimizing the problem of racism, white supremacy. Next, let's see. So she's talking about Mr. Patterson in New York. Patterson became a keen observer and practitioner of black political leadership. There's always this discussion of who is the leader. He told me, is it Jesse Jackson? Is it Reverend Al Sharpton? The question isn't who's the leader. The question is how badly we need them. If you lived in Scarsdale in New York, who cares who the leader is? Everybody's doing great. What do you need a leader for? I thought that was interesting in many respects. I think a retired firefighter echoed my point about what we mean when we say leader. Same thing with community, same thing with accountable, having definitions that make sense for these terms with some counter-racist logic. And yeah, these, I mean, moving forward. I thought the commentary about Mr. Patterson's father and how he thought he was going to be able to win, and then it turned out that he did not. I thought that was fascinating again. The humiliation that I think a lot of times happens for victims of racism when we are qualified, competent, capable, being able to go out and do things, and then just racism, whites do not allow us to do those things. That is 2017. That continues to be the case for many black people. Let's see. I thought it was presented earlier as though, you know, females have such a difficult time becoming governor, and there have been 4 black male governors, like, ever. Like, that seems like a real small figure. It seems like the overall pattern is that white people are going to be governors, particularly white males, but increasingly that is not even the case. But certainly white is the overall pattern. Moving forward, I thought it was when, at the time, Governor Patterson, first black governor in New York, when he's talking about being referenced as the accidental mayor, they always find some way of just showing that you are still a nigger, basically, to make it plain. They always find some way of doing that. It doesn't matter if you're president. And first, you see the way that President Obama's been treated the last 8 years, he and Michelle Obama, their children. It's some way of letting you know you're still a nigger. I don't care what your title is. Take that, accidental governor. Take that. I thought it was interesting that he would bring that out at the NAACP. Like, is this something that he does not feel comfortable addressing with normal members of the press? Like, he couldn't have talked with members of the New York Times to let them know that he is tired of being continually referenced as the accidental governor of New York? And matter of fact, to that very point, 2 paragraphs after, he brings this up, being referenced 27 times as the accidental governor. Most of the time, though, Patterson took the edge off uncomfortable situations with a joke or an easygoing smile. Black mental health. Black mental health. I wish we had Dr. Wellson here just to get her analysis of that right there, because I think a whole lot of us can relate to that. Snickering, smiling, laughing, when that is the exact opposite of how we feel in the system of white supremacy. Them calling you the accidental governor and you have to snicker and grin. Let's see. What else do I want to make sure I get in? There were some interesting articles referenced in this section of the reading as well. The word straddle came up here as well. Harold Ford Jr., who is married to a white woman, Ford remains adamant that straddles like these, making concessions to white people, that you're not going to talk about racism. Let me give you the full context. 2 years later, in an open letter published in Newsweek, Ford urged Obama to run as he had. People know that candidates running for president don't just live the way they live, Ford wrote, but they want to know that they're understood and their daily struggles are respected. Ford remains adamant that straddles like these are essential for the new breed of African-American politician. I bring a little bit of a different orientation to it, he told interviewer Charlie Rose early in the 2008 primary process. I'm a member of the National Rifle Association. although that's not something that my party fully embraces yet. He did lose his run for Senate during, I think it might have been at this point, but he did lose his run for Senate. And this is, Mr. Ford is the person they ran the commercial with the white prostitute at the end saying, call me. And we played the sound clip 2 weeks ago because I knew this was coming up. We played the sound clip where Farrah Chidea, her panel was talking about that clip. And remember, the white guy said that that absolutely was not racist. And anybody who even thinks or implies that there was something racist about that, you're being racist. That was what the white guy on the panel said. But yeah, I thought just, I have no idea how white people, even now, 2017, would respond if President Obama came out and said, yeah, I'm a member of the National Rifle Association. Anybody. Michelle Obama said that. Cory Booker, any non-white person, particularly an elected official, I don't know if that would be a good thing or a bad thing. I do know the NRA is like super, super, super white. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? Some of the quotes I can deal. I'll give you a couple of the quotes that I picked out from some of the other pieces that are referenced. She has one quote from an article. It's in the New York Times. It's titled, "Is Obama the End of Black Politics?" And this is an article from 2008 before he had won the election. It says, "For a lot of younger African Americans, the resistance of the civil rights generation to Obama's candidacy signified the failure of their parents to come to terms at the dusk of their lives with the success of their own struggle to embrace the idea that black politics might now be disappearing into American politics in the same way that the Irish and Italian machines long ago joined the political mainstream." Again, like I said, some of this is almost laughable, like to hear this being suggested in 2016 that, oh, yeah, we're taken care of. We don't even need any of that. You all have been so successful. Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton just knocked that racism thing out of the park. So, I mean, we don't even need all that silliness anymore. Like, it is laughable. And even that title, "Is Obama the End of Black Politics?" I read it in a very different sense. I think we talked about before, from last week, David Axelrod, the white man who ran Obama's campaign in 2008, said you can purposely give messages that have different meanings to different people. I have a very different meaning of this title now that I suspect a lot of people did back in 2008 when this article was read. And I am very comfortable stopping there, although I did want to get comments in about Jews, but I can wait till next week. Did anybody have anything quick they needed to get in before we wrap, or is everyone satisfied?
What you just laid out makes me think of these particular kind of black people, you know, God rest their soul, Gwynn Ifill and Ford Sr., Jr., Jackson Jr., Sr., and all these other very light-skinned, black-skinned people, black people that's running for office. It's like they like in the work they do, they kind of contradict themselves by saying that they too, their work is a farce because they believe that they have this perception that this separate group of blacks is no longer needed in American narrative, even though it continues to repeat itself that we will always be subjugated and regulated in every area of people activity in the United States. So I just find it so baffling for her to state in her book that, you know, black politics may not be necessary where we have the manifestation of this year's election. It's just like, really, people? Are you that delusional? And I just can't quite grasp their mentality and how they view the world. It's like they view the world in one way, yet they know they're lying to themselves, but they're going on with this lie of inclusion anyway. Does that make sense?
It does. I think number one, when you're in a system of racism, white supremacy, trying to figure out what to do is very difficult for a lot of people. I think confusion, number one, cannot be underestimated. I know a lot of people, they do not take that position. I know I can speak for myself. My conclusion, like 10 times out of 9, whoever the non-white person is, they probably do not have an accurate understanding of racism, and that alone is lethal. But I also think, again, you can incentives also. Whites can incentivize something. Bestseller, write this up. It is, you know, doing something. It is, you know, helpful. It is talking about racism where you might think that that's accurate. And she might not even have written this book. I'm not saying that to discredit her, but I am saying there is a documented history of white people writing things, racists writing things, and then showcasing, attributing that work to a non-white person to generate confusion so that it would be more readily accepted what is being said, especially if it's something about racism. So that could be what happened here. Let's assume that Gwen Ifill did indeed write this book. She could be confused. That's generally the position that I take. And also, as I said, whites, they can come in and a lot of influence. They can come in, as I stated before, they can threaten. They can come in and say, we want you to do it this way. It could be that the non-white person has been confused, as some of the folks in the book that have been presented, married to white people and what have you. They have a variety. When you are in a position of domination, there are a variety of ways that victims can be manipulated, exploited, so that you end up with products like this, things that end up, in my opinion, I think the typical non-white person, you read this book and you think Gwen Ifill is so esteemed, great award-winning journalist. She wrote this book about racism. It has to be accurate. A lot of non-white people would read this book. Actually, I don't know. If you read this book now, I don't know how far you would even get. You might just be like, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard reading it now. So I don't know. It has not aged well, and for that, I guess I'm thankful. I'll end there. If you read the book now and you've been paying attention at all to what has happened, Trump being elected, the Tea Party, anything that has taken place over the last decade or so since this book came out, I suspect a lot of people would not get very far. It would be flagrant that, wow, this person did not know what was going to happen, or things changed drastically from the time that this book was written. Like, the whole world shifted from 2009 January when President Obama was inaugurated. And I would say if you were seeing racism, white supremacy, you could see this was going to happen. Dr. Welsing, she seemed to be very clear what was going to happen from the moment he took office. I'll hop there. We had people that called in. You know what you did? You waited until super, super late to dial in. We're not doing that today. We'll teach you to get your hand up earlier in the program. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific, and then we'll be here on Sunday, December 25th. I think Dr. Rasayan will be here. We'll share a few views if folks want to share if anything interesting of note goes down with the celebrations and what have you over the weekend, but that'll be normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We don't do holidays. If you have questions, problems, if you want to see some of the visuals of some of the folks that have been discussed in the book, Harold Ford Jr. or Jesse Jackson Jr., so you can see what some of these people look like, Artur Davis, feel free. I can even post some of the articles on the Facebook page as well. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I also posted on social media earlier. They have increased sobriety checkpoints for the weekend. I would take that as a cue to promote sobriety. We already have enough problems. They are going to be looking to boost their revenues at the end of the year. Make sure they do not get any of our nickels. Be buckled up if you're going to be in a vehicle, and you certainly do not want to be under the influence, passenger, driver, even as a pedestrian. You do not want to be stopped. Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any other race soldier, badge or no, and have to explain what is happening, what's going on. Cut all of that out if you're going to consume whatever it is. Stay at the residence. Stay overnight. That way you can leave the following day when you're sober and make sure you don't have any problems. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. Keep ourselves as safe as possible. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, no brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.